Berlin with me, Francis Whateley, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Saturday night at 8.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 10th of September. This is Today with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning: the early release of prisoners in England and Wales to ease overcrowding in jails is just getting underway. We'll be speaking to the Chief Inspector of Prisons at 8:10. MPs will vote later today on government plans to restrict the winter fuel allowance to only the poorest pensioners. We'll be speaking to one of the Labour MPs planning to abstain and to a cabinet minister at 8:20. Officials in Gaza say at least 40 people have died in Israeli strikes on a camp for displaced Palestinians. Israel says it targeted a Hamas command centre.
Also in today's programme, rare access to Afghanistan, where we'll be reporting on the desperate situation facing women and girls under Taliban rule.
A lot of anxiety, a lot of fear. There is no hope. It's better to die than to live in this situation.
We'll be asking if the Princess of Wales's openness about her cancer treatment has helped other people with the disease. And
I am your father.
We'll be reflecting on the extraordinary career of the actor James Earl Jones, the voice of Darth Vader, who has died at the age of 93. That's all after the BBC News, read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The government has begun releasing offenders early from jails in England and Wales to try to ease overcrowding. Around 1,700 inmates are expected to be freed today. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said ministers had taken every measure available to protect the public, but concerns have been expressed about offender rehabilitation and ensuring victims are safe. Here's our Home and Legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
Today's release has immediately reduced the prison population in England and Wales and create breathing space for prison officers who say they are battling to keep institutions safe. The scheme to release offenders on licence after they've spent 40% of their sentence locked up excludes those convicted of sexual offences, domestic abuse crimes and serious violence, but it's not without risks. Those released will spend their first day of freedom meeting probation officers and learning of their licence restrictions. But despite almost 2 months of planning, it's unclear whether they'll all have a place to sleep.
MPs will vote later today on government plans to restrict the winter fuel payment to all but the poorest pensioners. Last night, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, met Labour backbenchers in an attempt to quell dissent about the money-saving move. Separately, Keir Starmer is due to warn the Trades Union Congress that more tough decisions are on the way. This report from our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
This winter, around 10 million pensioners will no longer receive the winter fuel payment. Sir Keir Starmer's huge majority means that today's vote won't change that. 17 Labour MPs have signed a motion calling for the cut to be postponed, but ministers insist it has to happen now to make savings in this financial year. They say they have no plans to offer any further support, pointing to the £900 increase in the state pension since last year. When he addresses union leaders at the Trade Union Congress in Brighton, the Prime Minister will warn that there are more tough decisions on the horizon.
The Civil Defence Agency in Gaza says at least 40 people have been killed and more than 60 wounded in Israeli airstrikes on a camp in which displaced Palestinians were living in tents. Many more are reported to be buried at the site in the Al-Mawasa area in southern Gaza. Israel has designated the area a humanitarian zone, but the country's military said it had targeted a Hamas command centre. The public inquiry set up after Lucy Letby was convicted of murdering babies at the Countess of Chester Hospital will open in Liverpool today. The inquiry will examine how hospital managers responded to doctors who raised concerns. Judith Morris reports.
Lucy Letby stands convicted of murdering 7 babies and attempting to murder another 7 between June 2015 and June 2016. Her trial raised questions about the way hospital managers handled concerns that consultants were raising about the nurse. It'll be for the public inquiry chaired by Lady Justice Thirlwall to examine that and whether there are questions for the wider NHS. The Thirlwall inquiry was set up very shortly after Letby was convicted in August 2023. Now it's getting underway at a time when a number of critics are arguing that she may in fact be innocent, but the inquiry won't get into the detail of exploring that issue.
The Children's Commissioner for England says pupils with special educational needs are overrepresented in those recorded as missing from school. Rachel D'Souza says it's a scandal that so many young people are out of education. Our education editor, Bramwen Jeffries, reports.
Almost a quarter of children recorded as missing from education in England have special educational needs. Some may have failed to find a suitable school place, or the needs set out in their care plan are not being met. The issue reflects the wider pressures in a special educational needs system which parents, schools and local authorities say is broken. The government has said it will look at how schools can be more inclusive and support these children's needs better.
Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced plans for a ban on children using social media. He said the impact of the sites on young people was a scourge and they should instead be outside playing sport. The legislation will enforce a minimum age, expected to be between 14 and 16, to use platforms such as Facebook and Instagram by the end of the year. James Earl Jones, the acclaimed American actor who was the voice of Darth Vader in the Star Wars films, has died at the age of 93. In a career spanning several decades, he found success on stage, film and television, winning Tonys, Emmys and an honorary Oscar. His credits include The Lion King, Coming to America and The Hunt for Red October. He had a stutter as a child and said acting allowed him to overcome a lack of self-confidence.
I was mute until I was about 14 because I'm a stutterer. I still am a stutterer. And when I learned how to work around that stutter, I learned the great beauty in those who could speak. I wanted to speak some too, not just the sound of my voice, but the sound of words and the meaning of words.
James Earl Jones, who's died at the age of 93.
Thank you. 6 minutes past six is the time. Let us have a look at the weather for the first time this morning. It comes from Simon King at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Justin. It is going to turn much colder over the next couple of days. We're going to see some pretty cold nights as well, especially Thursday night into Friday. A touch of frost potentially across northern England and across Scotland. The other thing about the weather over the next few days is the wind. Really quite blustery conditions expected today, especially across some parts of northern Scotland. And we've got some rain today. But for southwest and southeast England, while it's a mostly cloudy start of the day, we'll see a few breaks in the cloud, especially in the southwest. A few showers developing here before we get rain moving into all parts by this evening. Turning quite blustery with maximum temperatures of 16 to 18 degrees. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, again, pretty cloudy with some light rain starting to move in across some northern areas. This band of rain will move southwards, so by the middle part of this afternoon, parts of South Wales, the South Midlands into southern Lincolnshire will have that rain. Behind it to the north, there'll be some sunny spells developing. It's going to turn quite fresh and quite breezy, temperatures of 12 to 17 Celsius. For northern England and Northern Ireland, it's a cloudy and a damp start with some rain already. But that rain will clear southward quite quickly through the morning, just leaving sunny spells and showers. Some of those heavy, slight chance of a thunderstorm, turning windy and cool with highs of 11 to 13 Celsius. And across Scotland, it's a very wet start till Tuesday. And while the rain will clear from southern and eastern areas with sunny spells developing, we'll see heavy and frequent showers across northern and western Scotland, those thundery with some hail, some snow of the very highest ground as well, and strong winds, some gales in the far north, and highs of 9 to 12 Celsius.
Thanks, Simon. 8 minutes past six is the time. There's been an attack overnight in what Israel says is a Hamas command and control centre. The BBC's Joe Floto is in Jerusalem. Joe, what are each side in this conflict saying? Because they're very different stories that they're telling, aren't they?
They are very different stories. Let's start with what the residents of Al-Mawasi saw last night, just after midnight. They describe huge fireballs rising above the night sky in what is a designated humanitarian zone. So thousands upon thousands of displaced families are living under canvas and in improvised accommodation there. We spoke to one person, a volunteer from an aid agency, who ran towards the blast site, and he describes his shock at the scale of the destruction. Three large craters, he said, each about 7 metres wide, which had obliterated the tents that stood there. He reckoned there were about 20 tents that had been wiped out. And that there were people underneath the sand and rubble that had been thrown up by these explosions. The Israeli military, on the other hand, said they were targeting what they call significant Hamas terrorists, and that they'd taken steps, they say, to mitigate civilian harm, including using aerial surveillance to make sure that they were targeting, we imagine, the people that they wanted to get. But significant casualties, the civil defence are reporting around 40 dead and 60 wounded, and those shelters, those tents, would have afforded no protection at all from any of the blasts. So you can see how those casualty figures get so high.
Joe Clotet in Jerusalem, thank you.
It is now 6:10, and we turn to the inquiry, the public inquiry, into how and why Lucy Letby was able to murder seven babies and attempt to murder another seven at the Countess of Chester Hospital. The inquiry opens today. Rowan Bridge is watching. We've had the trial. What's the point of an inquiry, Rowan?
Well, really, I think they want to look into the circumstances of what happened and how that happened and what lessons there are to be learnt from that, not just for the Countess of Chester, but also for the wider NHS. The inquiry really has three strands. The first part of it will focus on the people at the heart of this, the families who've been affected by what happened at Lucy Letby's hands and their experiences at the Countess of Chester and with other authorities. And then they will also look, a second strand will look at the conduct of those who worked at the hospital. How was she able to do what she did? For example, hospital consultants and how their concerns were handled by senior management at the hospital. And then a third strand will look at the broader issues around the NHS and the culture within the NHS and whether there might be more that needs to be done to protect newborns.
How will the questions which are being raised about the verdict against Lucy Letby impact the inquiry, or even if it doesn't consider it, the families who are giving evidence there?
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of, it was described to me as by somebody as the elephant in the room on this case. There have been concerns raised by some about the convictions of Lucy Letby, about how some of the evidence that was presented there was interpreted and whether that was accurate and fair. Having said that, the case was taken to the Court of Appeal and her appeal was dismissed. The job of the inquiry is not to look at her guilt or innocence, it's to look at the circumstances around what happened. And this has been quite distressing for some of the families to hear the discussions that have gone on around her convictions. They feel very distressed that that is going on, but that's not really at the centre of what's happening here today.
And those seagulls are in the skies above Liverpool, are they, right?
They are indeed, and there's a street cleaner behind me as well, but hopefully you can't hear that.
No.
The seagulls are a bit more melodic.
Yes, they were. A rather lovely sound at this time of the morning. Rowan Bridge in Liverpool for that inquiry. Thank you.
Better than the cleaners at the Democratic Convention. were doing their wonderful work all around us as we were there. 6:12 is the time. Let's have a look at the papers slightly later than normal on the programme. The Princess of Wales featuring on almost all of the front pages, as you would expect, alongside her husband and children. The Mail saying her phrase, "out of the darkness can come light," is used as its main headline and describes the video announcing the end of her chemotherapy as deeply personal. The Times calls it slick. One for the Instagram generation, but concludes there's nothing confected about the emotion. Kate, it says, is at her most private and most genuine. The Sun describes the film as the most intimate look at royal life ever.
The other main issue for the papers is the looming Commons vote on winter fuel payments. The Guardian says the Prime Minister is defiant on the issue and that the Chancellor faced down would-be rebels when she addressed them last night. Rachel Rees has written an article for The Telegraph in which she says pensioners are on course for a £1,700 boost by the time of the next election. She says she's refused to duck difficult decisions. The Times still predicts a revolt by dozens of Labour MPs. It quotes one Cabinet Minister saying the row is already a massive issue on the doorstep and the government is at risk of ignoring the danger.
The Telegraph says the Victims Commissioner for London is warning that some people are not being told that their attackers are being freed early from jail as part of the scheme to tackle overcrowding. In an article for the paper, Claire Waxman says it could be a horrible shock for victims. The Express quotes experts who say that criminals are let out, who are let out early are likely to re-offend within days. An editorial in the Mail warns that freeing prisoners early poses an unacceptable risk to the public. It says Sir Keir Starmer portrays himself as a one-man crime-fighting machine because of his background as a prosecutor, but that this move suggests the pendulum has swung too far in favour of the criminals and away from the victims.
The evidence heard yesterday at the COVID inquiry offers a reminder of NHS workers' incredible dedication during the pandemic, according to the Mirror. The latest phase of the hearings focuses on the impact on the health service, as well as questions about how it coped. The paper argues the commitment of nurses and doctors is too often taken for granted. If we value our NHS, says its editorial, we should also value the heroes who work in it.
Time just come out, 6:15. iPhone sales have been slowing. Apple then has gone big on AI features to try to entice customers to upgrade. Is it all going to work? Sean Farrington is here with the answer to that and the whole of the rest of the business news as well. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Justin. Yeah, in the first half of this year, iPhone sales were actually down on the same period last year. But as with most of the world's biggest tech companies of late, Apple's share price has been shooting up, investors betting on artificial intelligence being the way to customers' hearts. So at the company's annual product launch event last night, the chief exec there, Tim Cook, told the world how it wouldn't be the hardware, the physical features of the iPhone that are changing drastically, but what's going on inside those software upgrades that will in theory use AI to help customers with photo editing, writing better, and more. Carolina Milanese is president and principal analyst at Creative Strategies and was at that launch event. Morning, Carolina.
Hi there.
How was it? Underwhelming or overwhelming?
It was actually kind of middle of the road. Like you said, from a hardware perspective, there was not big news, apart from the iPhone 16 that gets really bright new colors and a lot more features than we have seen in the past. The big news and what people are trying to still figure out is really Apple Intelligence.
Well, I'm guessing bright new colors isn't going to get people to part with thousands of pounds. So it's the artificial intelligence bit in there. What will it actually do? Will it come along quick enough for people to think, I'm going to spend more money on this stuff?
It's definitely not something that you're going to get out of the box all wrapped up in a bow. You know, it's going to take time for the real value of artificial intelligence to deliver, because the features are going to be delivered in a time frame that is not overnight. And so from a consumer perspective, you are buying into a promise of something that you will get over a period of time.
Yeah, so even though you might be able to put your pre-orders in by the end of this week and get the phone delivered by the end of the month, the actual software and these improvements that Apple are talking about may not kick in for you for many more months to come. And yet, Carolina, you know, Apple have spent fortunes. They say they spent $100 billion on research and development, as have other big tech companies. Are they providing their finished product quick enough to convince investors that they're actually going to make a return on all of that spend?
I think they are. And the two things that, in my opinion, are critical for Apple are, one, the trust that they have from the consumer in their brand and what they're delivering, and the big promise of privacy. And the other one that is more interesting to the investors is the fact that their Apple Intelligence is delivered on device. So while for some features you're going to have to go to their cloud, which is a secure cloud, and again, the promise of privacy to the consumer, there is less cost that running the kind of queries that we see today on Copilot, ChatGPT, Gemini, that rely on cloud, where, you know, the cost is more extensive for the brands.
So come on then, Carolina, what's the one feature of this AI that may get around to being on our phones one day that you thought that will actually be very useful to me?
I don't know if it's going to be useful or not, but everybody is waiting for Gemoji, the idea of having emojis that resemble you or whatever it is that you want to ask Apple AI to deliver for you. You know, I think at the end of the day, consumers are still really enamored with geeky and fun stuff.
Right. So we don't know if it'll be useful, but it might be fun. Carolina, thank you.
Exactly.
Carolina Milanese from Creative Strategies there, who was at that launch event at Apple last night. The head of National Grid has said an unprecedented level of investment will be needed to meet new government targets. Since coming into power, the Labour government has said it wants to press forward with its ambition to decarbonising the UK's energy network by 2030. And John Pettigrew is the chief executive of National Grid. He told me that private investment was ready and waiting to invest, but First Britain's planning system and regulation had to give him enough certainty for energy projects. I caught up with him about the scale of the challenge.
The target that the government set, I think, is a really good thing because it really does focus the mind. But it's hugely ambitious and it's going to require government to put the right policies in place. It's going to require regulators to ensure they've got the right regulatory frameworks to encourage investment in the UK. It's going to require the supply chain to increase its capacity to deliver all the equipment. And of course, National Grid has got a role to play in building out the transmission system, which is £30 billion in investment over the next 5 years. So it is absolutely hugely ambitious, but I think it's a good thing that the government has set a really ambitious target to focus everybody across the industry to really move things forward.
Ambitious. Is it actually achievable?
So it's going to require government to make policy changes in areas like planning and actually providing community benefits for people that are hosting infrastructure. It's going to require the regulator to put the right frameworks in place to encourage this level of investment, not just for companies like National Grid, but also things like the generators. We need to get to 50 to 60 gigawatts by 2030, and we currently have 15. So it's going to require a lot of investment from the generating community as well.
What is the biggest thing that needs to change in the planning system, from your perspective, that would mean, right, we can now achieve this target from a planning perspective?
If you look at the time scale it takes to build these big infrastructure projects in the UK, and typically it's sort of 10 to 12 years, and about three quarters of that time is the planning process, and about a quarter of it is actually the construction phase. So the more that the government can streamline that process and allow these big national infrastructure projects to be fast-tracked, then the more likely it is that we'll be able to achieve those targets.
To achieve those objectives, let's say there was even the planning system in place that you needed, there's still plenty of opposition from people, residents of these areas that would require this infrastructure to be built there. What do you do to counter that opposition? Or are you saying this needs building with their opposition existing? It needs to almost be bypassed.
Yeah, there are two things, Sean. I mean, first of all, listening to local communities and trying to find a solution that meets everybody's needs. Secondly, though, I think is that communities that do host this infrastructure should see some benefit. And that could be in the form of lower bills, or it could be direct investment in the local communities.
What about the money to get all of this stuff built?
The levels of investment that are going to be needed is unprecedented. So National Grid, for just its bit, which is to build the wires and the substations to connect the generation, is going to be spending £30 billion over the next 5 years. Obviously, all the generators have got to raise their money to be able to do their investments as well.
Can you explain where you literally get that money from?
So the way that National Grid funds all its investments is we raise money on the debt market, and we've actually directly raised money from our shareholders. And that allows us to make those investments. And then we recover those investments, the cost of those investments, from customers over 40 or 50 years.
When you talk about a focusing of minds with this shortening of the deadline to decarbonise the energy grid, so it being by 2030 now, is there a risk we'd take our eye off the ball when it comes to gas and the other ways that we get our energy that we are still hugely reliant upon, so that we don't get more blackouts?
I think it's just massively important to recognise that gas will continue to play an important role for many years to come. And therefore, you need to continue to invest in those gas networks and in gas generation as well. So typically, I think last year, gas was providing about 30% of the electricity that we use in the UK. That will shrink as we move forward, but it's going to be there for many years to come.
Let's just imagine the planning system changes the way you want it to, and all of these projects could come online so much quicker. Is the workforce there?
National Grid thinks that we'll be creating about 55,000 jobs just for the investment that we're doing. What we're seeing in our conversations with contractors is if we give them the visibility of the work that's coming over a long period of time, then actually, because the work is building up gradually, that we can develop the skills that we need.
John Pettigrew, Chief Executive of National Grid, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean.
Let's have a look at what's making a few headlines elsewhere this morning. I've got Christopher Ross back with me, who's the Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager at J. Stern & Co. Hi, Christopher.
Good morning.
The Times picking up today on something in the electric car battery manufacturing market, something we've discussed a lot about here in the UK, but the Swedish battery maker Northvolt has announced that it's going to cut its workforce. They're going to be scaling back operations generally to focus on their main factory in Sweden. What does this tell us about where this goes next for Europe, for the UK potentially?
Well, batteries and electrical vehicles are still at an early stage, and Northvolt is the big European hope. It's got 15 billion of investment behind it, but it's had huge delays in the batteries that they've produced. So BMW has just canceled a $2 billion order, and there's been delays that have affected BMW in cars, Scania, a Swedish truck manufacturer, in terms of the trucks with electric batteries that they've been able to deliver. And so it just shows how difficult it is to produce these things. It's not a UK issue. It's an issue that affects the UK. And I think it remains to be seen whether Northvolt can actually figure it out, or if the market is going to go to the Asian manufacturers that are much further ahead.
And in the Financial Times this morning, Christopher, talking about what is going on at News Corp, potential shakeup there right at the top. One of the investors, Starboard Value, they're called, activist investor, so looking to change things and how it's run, calling for the end of the Murdoch family control over the media conglomerate. Could that actually play out that way?
Well, good luck to them. We invest in companies that have quality and then can compound over the long term. We don't own News Corp, but we believe that corporate governance is really important. Rupert Murdoch controls it with 14% of the shares, but 41% of the votes. It's one thing if the founder has that kind of control. It's the same in Facebook, Meta, or in Google Alphabet. But there, these shares expire with the deaths of the founders. The fact that the Murdoch family wants to keep on keeping that control over time is not in line with corporate governance. And so it's a good point, and hopefully it'll go through.
Christopher Rosbach from J. Stern & Co., thank you very much.
And thank you, Sean. 26 minutes past six. What's the sports news this morning? Delith Lloyd can tell us. Morning, Delith.
A very good morning to you, Nick. Wales got their first win under head coach Craig Bellamy at the second time of asking. Despite torrential rain in Montenegro, Wales led 2-0 inside 3 minutes, thanks to goals from Kiefer Moore and Harry Wilson. And although they conceded late on, they held on in treacherous conditions.
It wasn't a football match. The conditions weren't going to allow it. And that's for both teams as well. So who's going to battle? Who's going to win the second balls? That's what it turned out to be. And you can take a lot of satisfaction from these type of games as well, because you show another side to yourself.
Elsewhere in the Nations League, Manchester City's Erling Haaland scored the winner as Norway beat Austria 2-1. Arsenal captain Martin Odegaard, though, limped off with an ankle injury. Harry Kane says he's targeting 100 goals for his country as he prepares to win his 100th cap this evening. He already has 66 goals in 99 internationals. The England captain will be presented with a golden cap before kick-off at Wembley. He's the first man since Wayne Rooney in November 2014 to reach the milestone.
I think these things are really important to acknowledge and to celebrate in the moment, because otherwise things just go by so quick, and then before you know it, you're thinking about something else. So important landmarks and stuff, you know, I'm extremely proud of, and I know my family and friends are proud of as well. So it should be a good night.
England face Finland. You can hear commentary on Five Live and BBC Sounds. England captain Ollie Pope says they were outplayed as Sri Lanka beat them by 8 wickets at the Oval. It's Sri Lanka's first test win over England in a decade. It meant England, though, finished the summer with a blot on their test copybook. One defeat added to the previous 5 wins. Here's Joe Root.
I don't think we played our best cricket this week, and that's going to happen from time to time. But, you know, like you look at Coldplay, they can't be number one every week. My point being is that, you know, we're always looking to try and move the game forward. We're always trying to find ways of winning. And we want to keep our catches in on a wicket that did have bounce, did have carry. Yes. As a batting group, we're always looking to try and find ways of putting opposition under pressure. You know, we're not always going to get it right all of the time.
Michael Vaughan is my guest at 7.25 this morning, while double Paralympic champion Maisie Newton-Smith, one of the stars of the Games in Paris, joins me in the studio at 8.25. Meanwhile, England's women thrashed Ireland in their second one-day international in Belfast by 275 runs. And Jack Draper is working hard to get fit for this week's Davis Cup Finals group stage. The US Open semi-finalist will join up with the rest of the GB squad in Manchester today, despite picking up a niggle in his match with Jannik Sinner in New York on Friday. And face Finland, Argentina and Canada this week at the Manchester Arena.
Della, thank you. 28 minutes past six. Tomorrow night, the news is going to be skewered. Here's someone who can try to make sense of it.
Welcome, John Holmes, curator of The Skewer.
Thank you.
Describe series 12 of The Skewer in one word.
New.
In one sound.
New.
In one emotion.
What?
In one internet meme.
No, I'm not doing that.
In one flavour.
This is stupid.
In one animal.
No.
In one literary quotation, so highbrow that only Radio 4 listeners will understand.
Oh, there was a young lady from Bude who went for a swim in the nude. A man in a...
Time's up. When does the new series of The Skewer begin on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds?
Tomorrow night at 11.15.
Look forward to that. Half past, or not quite half past six it is now. You're listening today on BBC Radio 4, Justin Webb and Nick Robinson. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
1,700 prisoners in England and Wales are being released this morning as part of attempts to ease overcrowding. The scheme will eventually make available as many as 5,500 prison spaces. Downing Street has acknowledged how incredibly difficult the move is for victims of crime, but says without action, police and courts could be left unable to lock criminals up. MPs will vote today on the government's plan to end winter fuel payments for all but the poorest pensioners. 10 million people will be affected by the move, which has been met with strong opposition by some Labour MPs and union leaders. Ministers say it's needed to save money, and last night the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, urged Labour backbenchers to support the motion, saying the party needed to govern with one voice. The Hamas-run civil defence agency in Gaza says at least 40 people have been killed and more than 60 injured in airstrikes on an area designated as safe by the Israeli military in the south of the territory. Israel says it targeted a Hamas command centre. The public inquiry set up after Lucy Letby was convicted of murdering babies at the Countess of Chester Hospital will open in Liverpool today. The inquiry, chaired by Lady Justice Thirlwall, will examine how hospital managers responded to doctors who were raising concerns. The BBC understands that ministers are preparing for confirmation this month of as many as 6,000 job cuts in the steel and oil and gas industries. Up to 3,000 positions are expected to be axed at British Steel in Scunthorpe and another 2,000 at Tata's Port Talbot site. It's also thought 400 jobs will be lost at Grangemouth Oil Refinery on the Firth of Forth. James Earl Jones, the American actor who was the voice of Darth Vader in the original Star Wars films, has died at the age of 93. Jones forged a distinguished career on stage, television and film, winning Emmy and Tony Awards and being given an honorary Oscar. He made his film debut in 1964 in Stanley Kubrick's Doctor Strangelove. He was also the voice of Mufasa in The Lion King.
Thank you. Just come out 28 minutes to seven. Today is the first day of the early release of prisoners, as we were hearing in the news, to try to relieve stresses on the system. Let's talk to Mark Easton, our home editor. Kick us off, Mark, with what's actually happening today and what's planned in coming days.
Yes, well, it's a very, very busy day for both the prison service and the probation service. 1,750 extra prisoners released today. That's on top of about 1,000 who are freed each week in the normal way. And as you say, that's just the first tranche, if you like, of 5,500 prisoners. We're talking England and Wales here, who are expected to be released between now and the end of October. Now, the first 6 weeks of this plan is going to involve prisoners serving less than 5 years, although that's not all of them, because obviously some prisoners are not going to be included. Those include serious violent criminals, terrorists, and domestic abuse perpetrators, which actually I think is going to be perhaps an area of particular concern for victims. So those serving time for coercive control, stalking, harassment, those kind of offences, they will not be released early. But many domestic abuse victims are concerned because, you might have been convicted of a crime such as common assault, which may not be flagged necessarily as domestic abuse, and you may therefore get through the system and come out early. And also prisoners who've completed a sentence for a serious crime, perhaps a domestic abuse crime, but are now serving a consecutive sentence for a lesser one, it might be something like breach of bail conditions or something, they will also be coming out potentially earlier than planned. So the real effort, I think, has been applied. Government says they've done a lot to trawl through to try and ensure that both victims know what's going to happen and any particular risks are looked at.
Oh, that's interesting about the contacting of the victims, because one of the criticisms you see, isn't it, is that not enough potential people who have been victims and potentially might be victims again of some of these people have been contacted. But you're saying there has been an effort behind the scenes to do that.
Oh, well, there always is an effort, actually, and it's a huge job for probation. So every prisoner who comes out today, whether it's as part of this scheme or in the normal way, they should at least meet their probation officer to understand the specific license conditions that apply to them. So they'll be looking at their accommodation, and that's a real problem, actually, in terms of providing enough spaces. They'll be carrying out home visits. They will be coordinating with victim liaison officers, domestic abuse support officers, and so on. It's a multi-agency effort to ensure that this thing happens as smoothly and as safely as possible. It's always a problem, you know, in the normal run of things. But what we have now is this additional number putting extra pressure on systems which are really already at the very edge.
OK, Mark Eason, thank you. And we'll be talking to Charlie Taylor, His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Prisons, at 8:10.
It is 26 minutes to 7 now. Let's stand, lead and govern together. That was the battle cry from the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, speaking to Labour MPs in the Commons last night, ahead of today's vote on winter fuel allowance. So, will they follow her? Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, has, as ever, his ear close to the ground in the corridors of Westminster. Morning to you, Henry. What are you hearing?
Well, look, it's not exactly a whopping great spoiler to tell you the government is going to win this vote. The winter fuel allowance is going to be means tested. That's the arithmetical reality of a situation where 404 of 650 MPs are Labour. But I think it really does matter for this government how it wins the vote. And Keir Starmer's whips are still trying to winnow that rebellion down. I think the number of Labour MPs who are going to vote against the government in the opposite division lobby today is going to be very small indeed. The question is how many abstain, how many signal by just sitting on their hands, finding a convenient reason not to be in the House of Commons, their discontent and their unease with what Rachel Reeves has done, and crucially, what that number then says about the further difficult votes that may be to come in the coming months and years.
And it was striking yesterday, wasn't it, that Dame Diana Johnson, a minister, was on this programme, seeming to hint that they'd look at ways to ameliorate the loss of that money to 10 million pensioners. And minutes later, you were out tweeting, saying you were getting calls from within government saying, no, we're not doing anything of the sort.
Yeah, I mean, very quickly, it became clear that that is not the position. Whether it had been the position or not, it is not the position. It's not the argument that Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, is going to be making today. The argument she's going to make is not about sort of cushioning the blow for some pensioners by other means. It's talking about the fact that pensioners on pension credit will still be able to claim the winter fuel allowance, and Number 10 are pointing to figures that say there were 38,500 applications for pension credit in the 5 weeks since this policy was announced, compared with 17,900 in the previous 5 weeks, so more than double. You've also got Rachel Reeves in the Telegraph today, pointing, interesting choice of paper given this is a policy that affects pensioners, talking about the fact that under the triple lock, which Labour are sticking to, pensions will go up by at least 2.5% every year of this government, which they say means that pensioners will be around £1,700 better off by the time of the next election. So no immediate measures to sort of soften or ameliorate the impact of this. But I do think some of those Labour MPs who have been persuaded by Rachel Reeves to support her on this because of the difficult decisions to come will want to see in the budget at the end of October a sense that in the round, it's not just pensioners taking the hit.
Henry Zeffman, Chief Political Correspondent, thank you very much indeed. We're going to be hearing from Government Minister from the Business Secretary after 8 o'clock.
23 minutes to 7 is the time now. There's been hope that the new government would intervene to stop job losses in some of our heavy industries. That hope appears to be fading. Let's talk to Simon Jack, our business editor, who is on the line. What can you tell us, Simon?
The government is bracing itself, Justin, for what they describe to me as a grim September. Look, the problems at places like Port Talbot, at Scunthorpe, at Grangemouth are not new. They've been hemorrhaging money for a long time. But as you say, there were some union hopes that a new government might be able to limit big job losses, could be as many as 6,000, particularly as they had a £2.5 billion manifesto promise of a kitty to revitalise the UK steel industry. But I'm told the new government has taken a similar line to its predecessor, sort of insisting that this public money is only available to invest in new, greener facilities rather than mop up and indemnify the ongoing losses of the past. And so we are going to see the axe fall at those sites. As I say, 2,800 going at Port Talbot, up to 3,000 at Scunthorpe, another 400 at Grangemouth. Now, the government spokesman said to me last night that these were tough decisions. You'll recognise that phrase, but insisted that the solution was not writing what they described as a blank cheque to bail out an industrial sector that the last government, they say, left on its knees by sitting on its hands.
I mean, is this a negotiating position in any way? Are they just trying to force more out of the companies involved, or are they simply, do you think, have they given up hope that these jobs effectively can be saved?
There is some progress that's been made on Port Talbot in the sense that there will be some training programs offered, paying people £27,000 a year for up to a year. But I think the prospects at Scunthorpe are the ones which have deteriorated the quickest, because there was hope that Jingye, the Chinese company that owns Scunthorpe, would keep a remaining blast furnace, very energy intensive, very labor intensive, open until these new electric arc furnaces, which are greener ways of making steel, was open. That could take up to 3 years. But I'm told that that prospect is now fading. I think the negotiating is largely done, which is why ministers and officials have said that the closures here, these job losses, are falling on their watch, which is going to make for a grim September, particularly as you've got the TUC conference going on as we speak.
Just a quick word about a very different industry that doesn't involve furnaces of any kind. Simon, the future of the Spectator newspaper, yes, or a magazine, decided, do you think?
I think it is, and I think that news could come any time as soon as today. I understand that Paul Marshall, the hedge fund tycoon Sir Paul Marshall, will close that deal for a price around £100 million. This is a publication that makes about £2 million, so it's a big multiple of that, which tells you everything you need to know about whether you consider it a trophy asset. That's one part of the media which is up for sale. Of course, that still leaves the Daily and Sunday Telegraph up there. That one will take a lot longer. Lots of interested bidders still in there. Originally, the UAE, the Gulf bidders, who paid off the previous owner's debts, put a value on the two titles of £600 million, which means that they are wanting to get around £500 million for Telegraph so that they can exit the stage with some,
alacrity.
Yes.
Simon, thanks.
It's 19 minutes to 7. That story matters a lot, doesn't it? Because Paul Marshall is one of the key funders of GB News. If he controls parts of telly as well as parts of print world, he will be quite a power in Conservative politics here and possibly around the world as well. Now, let's take a very quick look at the papers, dominated on the front pages by photographs from that extraordinarily powerful video released by the Princess of Wales to say that she'd ended chemo. The papers have their choice of front page headlines from her words. I want to stay cancer free. The Telegraph headline, my path to healing love and being loved is the sun out of darkness can come light, has the Mirror. Plenty of analysis too about what the royals are doing by producing this sort of video. Sarah Vine in the Mail says there may be some royal watchers who judge it a little over the top. It has an Instagrammable quality to it, but it's a generational thing, she says. They're millennial royals. The prince and princess grew up in a visual age, but also an age where expressing one's feelings is not frowned upon, as it was for King Charles and his mother.
And just one other story on the front pages that really catches the attention, which is that Germany, this is the front page of the Times, it's in other papers as well, Germans halt open border policy amid migrant crisis. Germany is going to challenge challenge the European Union's open borders and push back illegal migrants from next Monday as Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor, tries to appease public anger after a series of suspected Islamist attacks. And the Times says it's the first time since the creation of the EU's borderless Schengen area in the 1990s that controls will be introduced on all nine of Germany's borders, angering its neighbours.
It is now 18 minutes to seven. Our main news this morning, about 1,700 prisoners are being released early in England and Wales today as part of emergency plans to ease overcrowding.
Well, as we have been hearing, Keir Starmer facing a test of his authority this afternoon. MPs voting on plans to restrict winter fuel payments money to all but the poorest pensioners in England and Wales, with the government's proposals also criticised in the House of Lords. Here is our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
Ahead of today's vote, some Labour backbenchers and union leaders have warned the government it's making a mistake. Yesterday, a former Prime Minister pitched in.
To someone who made a promise to Britain's pensioners to keep the winter fuel payment and kept that for 6 years as Prime Minister, can I make a gentle suggestion to the government?
Having established his credentials, David, now Lord Cameron, set out his idea.
Instead of this misguided attack on the winter fuel payments, why not simply say that pensioners who are either higher rate taxpayers or additional rate taxpayers don't receive the winter fuel payment? You may only raise 10% of the money, but you'd save 90% of the shame and embarrassment of the current position.
MPs call the House of Lords the other place, and they do things differently there. For a start, peers tend to be more polite than the politicians in the Commons. So the Work and Pensions Minister, Lady Sherlock, began by thanking Lord Cameron for his suggestion, before telling him the government needed to find something that worked and was straightforward. It's thought about 800,000 people who are qualified for pension credit are missing out.
The pension credit system is established. People know it's there. Our job is to just make sure they can apply for it. Now, my lords, if we can do that, we can make sure that they get not just this £200 or £300, but the thousands of pounds they might be entitled to under pension credit.
Lady Sherlock said in the year 2021 to 22, it was estimated that 2.15 million people were eligible for pension credit and 1.35 million people claimed the benefit. None of the peers who spoke in the short debate supported the government's position. A Labour member, Lord Watts, sounded sympathetic when he suggested many of their lordships accepted there was a black hole in the budget.
Many of us also think that we're not against the principle of some form of means testing, but many of us think that the threshold is too low. And will the government look at the threshold again to see that poor pensioners are not excluded from a winter fuel allowance in the future?
Lady Sherlock said setting up a means testing system for the winter fuel allowance, which was a once-a-year, one-off payment, would create too much bureaucracy and red tape.
So we've ended up going for pension credit, which is already there. It also has the great advantage that if somebody is on pension credit, we can pretty much automatically give them the winter fuel payment so they won't have to apply for it. Whereas if we create some new special scheme, people would have to apply for it.
The Conservative spokesman, Lord Younger, called the cut to winter fuel payments an ill-judged decision, which had left the government between a rock and a hard place.
On the one hand, if there is a substantial increase in the uptake of pension credit, and of course we're all for that, the figures show that the increased costs will all but wipe out the net gain of £1.4 billion that the Treasury expects through the cut. On the other hand, with a poor or low uptake, it is apparent that many more of the most vulnerable pensioners will be hit.
For the Lib Dems, Lord Palmer of Childs Hill said many people didn't claim pension credit because of pride. Others struggled with the system.
Could the Minister tell the House how they're going to encourage these large number of people to actually claim pension credit? Because if they don't claim the pension credit, they won't have the winter fuel allowance. And I have doubts that people will actually claim to any great degree.
Lady Sherlock said her department was running a campaign to encourage more people to make a claim.
So can I urge all noble lords, by all means let's have the fight in here, but please put the word out. Let's get people to claim what they're entitled to.
Another Conservative, Lord Sherborne, asked about the Chancellor's decision-making process.
When the government came to look at where they wanted to cut public expenditure and looked at the various candidates for cutting, why did they choose winter fuel payments?
The minister said money had to be found in this financial year, and she warned peers this wouldn't be the last difficult decision the government would be forced to make. but a Green peer, Lady Jones, jumped in to challenge the government's thinking.
Tough decisions always hit the poor and not the fossil fuel companies and the water companies.
Lady Sherlock said the point was that most of the pensioners who'd be hit by this decision were not the poor. We'll find out later today how many Labour MPs agree with that argument.
We will indeed. And that was Sean Curran on Yesterday in Parliament. Brings us to 13 minutes to 7. The energy regulator Ofgem says customer service in the energy sector has got to improve or else. Tim Jarvis is Ofgem's Director General for Markets and is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
How bad is it at the moment?
Well, I think what we've seen over the last couple of years in the energy sector during the energy crisis and immediately afterwards was a fall in customer service standards as the sector struggled to deal with the demands on it. We've taken steps in recent years to drive those back up again and turn the corner. We've taken action on issues such as call waiting time, for example, where we've secured compensation for customers, but most importantly, driven those costs down, those times down. But I think there's much more to do. And I think what we're setting out today is a very high ambition to ensure that the best customer service is available for energy consumers, given the importance of energy to every household.
Yeah, because waiting times is one of it, and it's immensely frustrating for people when they're kept waiting. But there is also the business of once you've got through is where the problems are properly sorted out. And are you saying at the moment they are not being, in too many cases, properly sorted out?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. It's about much more than how long you have to wait. It's the service you get when you get through. And we see patchy service, to be honest. I speak to consumers regularly, and I speak to customers who describe very good service they've had from some energy suppliers, particularly if they're struggling with their bills and they're being directed to support and given forbearance on their bills where they're struggling. But I also speak to customers where that service is far short and they're being fobbed up, or if they've got a concern that they're having to ring up multiple times and it's not getting dealt with. So we need to drive up the service across the sector, and we're setting very high ambitions for the sector, and I'm keen to work with suppliers and consumer groups and others in government to make sure that we can really drive up those standards to be the best across all service sectors.
And if they don't improve standards, what sticks do you have?
Well, we have powers to take action against energy companies, and we have done so, and we've imposed fines and we've secured large amounts of compensation for customers. I think that's part of the tools that we need to provide, but we also need to make sure that we are setting out a very clear expectation for suppliers about the service that they need to provide, and making sure that we're taking action quickly when it's not, and that customers have access to quick compensation when they're not getting the service they need.
I mean, I suppose the other point is that as all of this becomes more complex, and I'm thinking about heat pumps and, I don't know, electric vehicles and all the rest, the amount of interaction that you're likely to have in the future, particularly with the electricity grid and your electricity supplier, is only going to get more complicated, isn't it?
It's definitely a much more complicated market than the market that Ofgem was set up to regulate. And what we're also looking today is open up that conversation with government about how we are set up to deal with some of that, and how we can make sure that we are supporting consumers during those much more complex interactions, as you say, where people are getting services from their energy suppliers now for electric vehicles and for heat pumps that they weren't getting before. So we're working with the sector on that, and we're working with consumer groups to make sure that we can really make sure that we're setting the right standards for customers and that they're getting the service they need.
Tim Jarvis from Ofgem, thank you.
It is now 9 minutes to seven. Help people to get a house first, worry about solving their other problems later. That's the philosophy behind a scheme in Greater Manchester called Housing First, which has offered homes to people with no strings attached for the past 5 years. People like Lisa, who told us how she lost her home on three separate occasions.
When I was 15, the first time I was homeless, my mum committed suicide, and then I was in a domestic violent relationship the second time I was homeless. I was on the drink for 11 years. Third time was through a house fire. But I've had no support or no services helped me in the past before. So I've just failed and just come back down a slippery slope. They had an housing officer called Richard. Because of all my depression and my health problems, he put me onto a support worker. I got help with furniture, help setting up my bills. Housing First has kept me on the straight and narrow, because I've not got my family without them. They've given me strength back, really. Give me my life back.
Today, the Mayor of Greater Manchester is arguing for an extension of funding for Housing First, alongside experts from Finland who inspired the approach. And we're joined by Andy Burning. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Explain the philosophy, if you would. Why make sense? Why does it make sense to give people a house without first insisting that they give up drink, drugs or deal with their other problems?
Because if people have suffered the trauma of rough sleeping or homelessness, they need breathing space to recover. And when I visited Finland, Nick, what I heard was, you know, those strings or those conditions that come from the benefit system or the housing system, they create a new crisis for people. And then, as Lisa just described, you know, people then are in this endless cycle of crisis. And it's just it's fantastic, actually, to hear her speaking just now. You know, the credit for Housing First originally goes to Sajid Javid, because he gave us the opportunity to set up a pilot alongside Liverpool City Region and the West Midlands. And the big learning, the big lesson that comes from it is a simple but profound one. If you set people up to succeed, they largely do. The vast majority of people will succeed. So around 75%, just over, of people who've come through our Housing First scheme have sustained their tenancies. And that is a result that has outstripped what people thought would happen.
So it's been going for 5 years. You think it's a success. It was a Tory government that helped you set it up in the first place. Your pitch now is to your Labour friends and colleagues in government, is it, to say, give us another 5 years or give us the power to do it permanently?
It's partly that. I mean, I think we have a habit in this country of setting up pilots and then not bothering to look at the results and implement them. The message is loud and clear here. You actually spend public money much more efficiently if you take this approach to helping people recover from homelessness. But I only say partly, Nick, because we're going to do it ourselves. I've asked my team at the Combined Authority in Greater Manchester to set up a Housing First unit. I think this philosophy of giving people a good home, a safe home before anything else, actually can be applied much more broadly. And I think, you know, if everybody in this country had a good, safe home, I think the British state would save billions on the cost of crisis in public services.
We've heard
it would
hints.
Actually be the best investment we could make as a country.
We've heard hints from the new welfare secretary that there may be many more powers given to mayors like yourself to make some of the crucial decisions about how to get the welfare budget down, helping people in the process, of course, but saving the taxpayer the Treasury money. Are you expecting to be given that job?
Well, the evidence is clear that we can get more people into work and we can help people through schemes like Housing First. Why do we have more ability to do that? Because we can take a bottom-up approach, joining the dots and putting in place that sort of wider support around people in a way that the silos of Whitehall simply can't do. So through the modest amount of devolution we've had from the Department for Work and Pensions, we have succeeded in getting more people into work than the National Work Programme has managed. So the evidence is, Nick, that devolution in England is working. But I would say it's got to be about home plus support. That's the learning from Housing First. If you give people the guarantee, the strong foundation of a good home, alongside personalised support, the vast majority of people will recover. Okay. And I think what we've had in this country is a sort of distrustful deficit model when it comes to the benefit system, more geared towards tripping people up rather than helping them out. So now, I do think it implies a paradigm shift in the way we think about benefits and the way we think about housing.
Now, talking of benefits, if you were still in the House of Commons, would you be voting for 10 million pensioners to lose their winter fuel allowance?
Well, my views on the parliamentary whip system are on record, and I think I find this, you know, a situation that I can remember from my time in Parliament where it's going to be very difficult for MPs today. What I would say is a few things. I would say that it is clear to me that the government's been dealt a very bad hand of cards from the previous government when it comes to the public finances. I also think there is a case for reform of the winter fuel allowance. I would just ask the government not to rule out the possibility of a higher threshold or indeed a taper of winter fuel allowance, because our our experience in Greater Manchester is that pensioners are often reluctant to apply for the pension credit for a number of reasons. And actually, anyway, the threshold at which you get it is it is pretty low anyway. And so I recognise how difficult the situation is. And I do think, you know, there is a case, as I said, for reform. But I would ask them not to rule out putting in that that possible extra help for pensioners who are right at that cliff edge.
Andy Burnham, Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, thanks for joining us.
3 minutes to seven. Simon King with the weather.
Justin, yeah, it's going to turn much colder over the next couple of days, along with some pretty strong and blustery winds across many parts of the United Kingdom. And for today, rain is in the forecast, which is currently moving its way southward at the moment across Scotland and Northern Ireland. But in the southwest and southeast of England, it's pretty cloudy this morning. A few breaks of the cloud expected in the southwest, and then we'll see some rain moving in, particularly later on into the evening. It's only quite breezy and temperatures of 16 to 18 degrees. Meanwhile, for Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, it's pretty cloudy. We've got some light rain starting to move in across northern areas, and that's going to move further southward as we go through into the afternoon. Behind it, there'll be some sunny spells developing, and it's going to be quite breezy and fresh, temperatures 12 to 17 degrees. Across northern England and Northern Ireland, it's pretty wet at the moment. We've got that rain moving its way southward across all parts, really. As that rain clears to the south, there'll be some sunny spells and showers, some of those heavy, potentially thundery, turning quite windy, and temperatures of 11 to 13 degrees. And across Scotland today, it's a very wet start to the day. We've got some of that rain moving its way from the south and the east with sunny spells developing, but there'll still be some heavy and frequent showers across the far north, especially the far northwest. Some of those thundery with hail bursts over the higher ground and strong winds with gales in the far north as well.
Simon, thank you.
Drift away with the sleeping forecast. A gentle mix of ambient music and the restful sounds of Radio 4's shipping forecast.
Fourth, tide, dogger, fisher, German bite, humper, south or southwest.
Handcrafted to soothe your soul. The sleeping forecast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Coming up in the next hour, has the Princess of Wales' openness about her cancer treatment helped other people with the disease? And there will be tributes to the actor James Earl Jones, the unmistakable voice of Darth Vader, who's died at the age of 93.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 10th of September. The headlines this morning: the government has begun releasing prisoners early in England and Wales as part of efforts to ease overcrowding. MPs will vote today on whether to support plans to stop winter fuel payments to millions of pensioners. And officials in Gaza say an Israeli airstrike on a designated humanitarian zone has killed more than 40 people. Israel says it was targeting a Hamas command centre. The BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The government has begun releasing offenders early from jails in England and Wales to try to ease overcrowding. Around 1,700 inmates are expected to be freed today as part of a scheme intended to make available up to 5,500 prison places. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said ministers had taken every measure available to protect the public, but concerns have been expressed about offender rehabilitation and ensuring victims are safe. Here's our home and legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
Today's releases immediately reduce the prison population in England and Wales and create breathing space for prison officers who say they are battling to keep institutions safe. The scheme to release offenders on licence after they've spent 40% of their sentence locked up excludes those convicted of sexual offences, domestic abuse crimes and serious violence, but it's not without risks. Those released will spend their first day of freedom meeting probation officers and learning of their licence restrictions. But despite almost 2 months of planning, it's unclear whether they'll all have a place to sleep. Rehabilitation charities fear many will struggle to find work because they have not finished prison courses in time. There's little opposition to the scheme at Westminster, as the plans were drawn up by the Conservatives earlier this year. But Charlie Taylor, the Chief Inspector of Prisons, has said the government must now take sustained, decisive action to make life safer within jails and protect communities when people are released.
MPs will vote later today on government plans to restrict the winter fuel payment to all but the poorest pensioners. Last night, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, met Labour backbenchers in an attempt to quell dissent about the money-saving move. She said it was the result of what she called reckless decisions the Conservatives made while in office. Separately, Sir Keir Starmer is due to warn the Trade Union Congress that more tough decisions are on the way. This report from our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
This winter, around 10 million pensioners will no longer receive the winter fuel payment. Sir Keir Starmer's huge majority means that today's vote won't change that. 17 Labour MPs have signed a motion calling for the cut to be postponed, but ministers insist it has to happen now to make savings in this financial year. They say they have no plans to offer any further support, pointing to the £900 increase in the state pension since last year. At a meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party last night, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, urged Labour MPs not to abstain, calling on them to stand, lead and govern together. When he addresses union leaders at the Trade Union Congress in Brighton, the Prime Minister will warn that there are more tough decisions on the horizon. The government's hoping it can show unity in taking such moves ahead of the budget in October.
Gaza's civil defence agency says an Israeli attack near the southern city of Khan Yunis has killed 40 people and wounded dozens. The strike hit Al Mawasa, which was designated a safe zone by the Israeli military early in the war. Thousands of displaced Palestinians have taken refuge there. Israel said it was targeting a Hamas command centre. Joe Floto sent this report from Jerusalem.
Residents describe how, shortly after midnight, explosions sent huge fireballs into the night sky above Al-Mawasi, a designated humanitarian zone in the southwest of the Gaza Strip, housing thousands of displaced families in tents or improvised shelters, none of which would have afforded much protection from the blast. One witness described to the BBC how he and other volunteers rushed to the site of the explosion, only to find three large craters where once a group of 20 tents had stood. The Israeli military said it was targeting what it called significant Hamas terrorists operating a command and control centre in the humanitarian zone. It claimed it had taken numerous steps to mitigate the risk of harming civilians.
The public inquiry set up after Lucy Letby was convicted of murdering babies at the Countess of Chester Hospital will open in Liverpool today. The inquiry, chaired by Lady Justice Thelwell, will examine how hospital managers responded to doctors who were raising concerns. Judith Morris reports.
Lucy Letby stands convicted of murdering seven babies and attempting to murder another seven between June 2015 and June 2016. Her trial raised questions about the way hospital managers handled concerns that consultants were raising about the nurse. It'll be for the public inquiry chaired by Lady Justice Thirlwall to examine that and whether there are questions for the wider NHS. The Thirlwall inquiry was set up very shortly after Letby was convicted in August 2023. Now it's getting underway at a time when a number of critics are arguing that she may in fact be innocent, but the inquiry won't get into the detail of exploring that issue.
The Conservative leadership contest will lose another candidate today, taking the number of contenders down to four. In the first round of voting, Robert Jenrick emerged as the frontrunner, followed by Kemi Badenoch, James Cleverly, Tom Tugendhat and Mel Stride. They're also in the race. The final four will take their campaigns to the Tory conference before the contest is whittled down to a final two candidates. The BBC understands that the government is bracing itself for the confirmation of up to 6,000 job losses this month. Up to 3,000 posts are expected to be axed at British Steel in Scunthorpe, while 2,800 are set to go at Port Talbot. It's thought there'll be a further 400 job cuts at the Grangemouth Oil Refinery on the Firth of Forth. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Ministers have privately conceded that this month will see what they describe as a grim series of redundancy announcements in South Wales, the North East and Scotland. Labour's manifesto promised a kitty of £2.5 billion to revitalise the UK steel industry, but the new government has taken a similar line to its predecessor by insisting that public money is only available to invest in new, greener production facilities rather than to subsidise large ongoing losses at carbon-intensive plants. Both Port Talbot owners Tata and Scunthorpe owners Jingye insist the plants are losing up to £1 million a day. Scotland's only oil refinery, Grangemouth, is expected to cease operations early next year to become a hub for foreign energy imports.
Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced plans for a ban on children using social media. He said the impact of the sites on young people was a scourge and they should instead be outside playing sport. The legislation will enforce a minimum age expected to be between 14 and 16 to use platforms such as Facebook and Instagram by the end of the year. The acclaimed American actor James Earl Jones, who used his booming, distinctive voice to bring Darth Vader to life in the Star Wars films, has died at the age of 93. His career, spanning several decades, was littered with accolades, including 2 Tony Awards, 2 Emmys, a Grammy and an Honorary Academy Award. He was a star of stage, television and film, but as our arts correspondent David Sillitoe reports, it's his voice for which he'll be more warmly remembered.
The voice of Darth Vader. This alone guaranteed James Earl Jones a place in Hollywood history, but when Star Wars first came out, he didn't even appear in the credits. However, it was just one of dozens of roles. His remarkable voice can be heard in The Lion King.
One day, Simba, the sun will set on my time here.
And even a famous news sting.
This is CNN, a network of Turner Broadcasting System.
But as a teenager, he refused to speak.
I was mute until I was about 14 because I'm a stutterer. I still am a stutterer. And when I learned how to work around that stutter, I learned the great beauty in those who could speak.
It was drama that helped him find his voice after the traumas of his Mississippi childhood and led to a successful stage career at a time when there were few black actors on Broadway. He is one of a select number with an Emmy, a Grammy, an Honorary Oscar and a Tony. There was rather more to him than just the voice of one of cinema's great villains.
I am the father.
David Sillitoe reporting.
7:09. Out today, prisoners who have not completed even half of their sentences, not met the requirements of justice as laid down by the law and the judges who sentenced them. Out because, well, there isn't enough prison space to house them. Of course, prison is not always doing either the offenders or indeed wider society much good, particularly if the prison is unsanitary and lacking in the ability to help with rehabilitation. More on all of that at 8:10. But right now we are looking at how well we are fixed to deal with the post-prison lives of those who are coming out today. And we can do so with Martin Jones, who is His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Probation. Mr. Jones, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you accept that what is happening today had to?
Absolutely. I mean, the pressure on our prisons is extreme. It's the highest population we've ever seen in this country. Prisons are absolutely close to 100% capacity. My understanding, as of yesterday, is there are a couple of hundred spaces remaining.
Can the probation service then cope with what is happening today, and particularly, I suppose, with the amount of notice that you've had of it happening?
So I think there's one thing I want to say up front, actually, which is there's been a huge amount of pressure on the probation service over the last 8 weeks. Certainly the timetable has not been as good as people would have liked. I would just like to pay tribute to the frontline workers on the probation side who have been doing a huge amount of work to ensure they are as ready as they can be. But I fear there will be pinch points in the coming days and weeks, particularly, for example, around accommodation and ensuring that the probation officers have the information they need to manage those cases successfully.
Right, so to put it bluntly, there are some people who are going to be released and won't have anywhere to sleep. They'll come out of prison today, they won't have anywhere to sleep tonight.
Well, that's absolutely the risk. I mean, if you look at the numbers, in any given period, about 1 in 7 people released from prison are homeless. And what you're seeing this week is nearly 2,000 people being released. That's nearly twice the number that would ordinarily be released in any given week. That's placing significant pressure on the probation service and the people that provide the accommodation underpinning that.
At a significant risk, presumably, as well, that they will reoffend.
So I think there are 3 different risks here. The first risk, and I think the one that is almost bound to happen, is that things will go wrong in the community, and within days or weeks, some of those people will end up being sent back to prison because they breached the terms of their licence. So they haven't reoffended, they breached the terms of the licence, they need to go back to prison. There's also, I think, a certainty that some will reoffend. So the numbers are that around about 1/3 of people released from prison each year have proven to have been committed a further offence within a year. And then, of course, there's a small risk that some of those offences will be serious. Now, whilst rare, that risk cannot be eliminated.
You pay tribute to your
staff. Do you have enough of them? Are there enough of them? And what kind of conditions are they working in?
Well, obviously, as the chief inspector of probation, they're not my staff. I inspect them, and sometimes I give them a hard time. Sometimes I criticise them for their performance and the fact that they should be doing more. But underpinning it all, I think there's a real a lot of the attention has been on the prisons crisis. But if you look at the pressures on probation, they are just as extreme. We have too few probation officers, too few experienced probation officers, and that means that service is significantly overstretched.
Why is that? Is it pay? Is it conditions? What is it that causes?
So I think there's a whole complex set of things that are here. I think part of it probably is pay, and that needs to be looked at. You know, what is the value of having a probation officer that can properly supervise somebody as they leave prison today? I would say that's incalculable to ensure that you have the resources in place. But some of it I also think is structural, to ensure that you're bringing people in and you're retaining them. Obviously, the probation service has been subject to significant reorganisation over the last 10 years, and I think that has impacted on morale in the service.
Well, reorganisation along what lines?
So in 2015, part of the probation service was privatised. That was reversed some 5 years ago. But again, you just get the impact of a major reorganisation, and that then impacts upon the service delivery.
It's partly a kind of the seriousness with which we take the prison system, the justice system, all of these systems, isn't it? And the amount of effort, it's not just money, is it? It's kind of public attention, in a sense, that these things have been lacking. Well, that's been the criticism from within. And we certainly hear from criminal barristers regularly that, you know, they also feel that they're badly paid and that the system hasn't had proper attention paid to it. How hopeful are you? Or I suppose, what would you say to the government with all the other pressures? My goodness, we've talked about a few of them on them. How important is getting this right?
Well, I've spent the last 30 years working in the criminal justice system, and I would say having a healthy criminal justice system that's able to deal with those who commit offences quickly, fairly, and then sentence those people appropriately, do good in prison so they're less likely to reoffend, and then ensure they are properly supervised in the community thereafter, is absolutely a building block of a civilised society. It's not a political point, but it means, I mean, we've got evidence that good probation practice keeps communities safe and keeps the public safer. Why would you not want to do that? And indeed, of course, you'd save a huge amount of ongoing resources. I mean, there's a huge cost to crime itself. So I do think there is a way, a proper, well-judged investment in the criminal justice system will improve and make people's lives better.
Martin Jones, His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Probation. Thank you.
It's 14 minutes past seven. Don't blame us, blame the Tories. That was Rachel Reeves' message to Labour MPs, threatening to rebel today over the government's plan to cut winter fuel allowance from 10 million pensioners. Anxious Labour MPs now have a choice: defy their leadership, vote against and risk expulsion from the parliamentary party, or face the electoral risk of being seen to allow a policy which the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, an anti-poverty charity, says could push 100,000 pensioners into poverty. Rachel Maskell joins us. She's the chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Ageing and Older People, and one of those who signed an early day motion calling for this policy to change. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Vote against or abstain?
Well, I'll be abstaining because I want to work with Labour to find the mitigation which is going to be absolutely necessary to keep the cold from older people. Of course, they've got the hardest budgets of all to balance as they make the decision how they keep themselves warm. And I want to ensure that they get the protection they need this winter, that they're warm and well, and that they ultimately know that the government is providing that protection. And it's absolutely crucial as we're seeing energy prices going up again from the 1st of October and people be worried about those bills.
Sure, but you say you want to work with ministers to get mitigation. And yet, when a minister came on this programme and started talking about possible concessions, she was instantly slapped down by Downing Street saying, we're not doing any of that. Have you had some private reassurances?
Well, government are going to have to, because they need to protect the NHS this winter. We know that the NHS is in crisis. We're hearing that from the Health Secretary.
Yeah, but have you had any assurances that they will? You may say they have to. They may disagree with you.
Well, in politics, it's not just about what ministers say. It's about what MPs do, and to press into that political space to put the case, which research is showing, academics, epidemiologists, medics, and so many more, and to say we need to protect older people this winter. We know that it does have a real impact on people's health, and ultimately we have got to protect the NHS because it can't cope with more pressures, but we also need to assure older people that they will be safe and warm this winter.
Let me be clear what you're saying. You want a payment that isn't limited to the very poorest pensioners who get pension credit, but you don't want to retain a payment that goes to everyone. You want something in the middle.
Well, I'm very clear that the ambition that Labour have got to take those 880,000 people who are eligible for pension credit into getting that payment. But we know that there is about a million people just above those thresholds who also are fuel poor, and they need the protection too. Charities and other organisations are saying that the ambition of government will be hard to reach, and that's why we're calling for a delay in the implementation of these regulations. But if that isn't achieved, we clearly need the mitigation necessary from a social tariff, so those energy giants profiting to the tunes of billions of pounds can keep people warm, or also looking at things like social prescribing, fuel, energy support, so that those very poor people who are struggling this winter can have the help that they need to stay warm.
Rachel Maskell, thank you. We'll be talking to Government Minister, the Business Secretary, about 20 past 8.
17 minutes past 7 is the time now. The latest jobs market data is in, and Sean is back with it. Morning again, Sean.
Yes, morning. It's an important one, this, because particularly when it comes to the numbers that are put out by the Office for National Statistics, because this is the month where the government will look at how much wages are rising by as part of its triple lock around the full state pension. And if they end up going with the 4% figure that came in for the annual rate of wage increase to May to July this year, then that would be an increase on the full state pension by £460 a year from April, if that ends up being the number they go with, which, you know, they say with the triple lock, that is likely to be the number. It can be revised a little bit by the Office for National Statistics. So that's one part of the data. Another part of the data tells us that the unemployment rate is now back down to 4.1%. And when they look at pay, the Office for National Statistics, they say that overall it has slowed markedly, because there were one-off payments, so technically bonuses, that were given to public sector workers in the summer last year. James Reid is chairman of Reid, one of the UK's largest recruitment businesses. James, morning.
Hello, Sean. Good morning.
How does this tally with what you're seeing when it comes to pay? Are you seeing a slowdown markedly?
Yes, we have. We've seen pay slow down over the course of the year. And our data is exactly the same at the moment. 4% is what it's showing. So that's for August. That's our latest data. But pay is going up most in areas where there are acute skill shortages, so areas like construction, engineering, education. So some sectors are seeing more buoyant pay rises.
At the same time, this data showing vacancies are lowest in 2 years. So what is businesses thinking there that's leading to lower vacancy numbers, continually lower vacancy numbers?
Well, the most worrying statistic, I think, in today's release is that for the 26th consecutive period, vacancies have declined. For the quarter, they're saying they're still above pre-pandemic levels, but our Reid data showed vacancies declined 28% in August, which is below August 2020. So vacancies are continuing to decline. I think employer confidence has taken a knock, really. I'm not sure whether it's a combination of interest rates or uncertainty around new regulations or taxation. But I'm concerned about this, and it's important for a tough 6 months ahead, I think.
And what could play out in that 6 months?
Well, employers are keeping a keen eye on new worker rights regulations. And there's certainly one, which is the first day full rights from day one, that I think is concerning some employers and is acting as a brake on hiring. Because employers are worried, you know, that they don't have a get-to-know-you period or won't have a get-to-know-you period. And it's also acting as a brake, I think, on the chances for individuals to get jobs. You know, if you're trying to, if you're coming into the labour market the first time as a first-time jobber, or you're an ex-offender and we're trying to place you into work, it makes employers feel that they have to be really, really sure they want a person before they hire them.
James.
And so I hope they look at that more carefully.
Thank you very much, James Reid, there, chairman of Reid.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. 21 minutes past seven. Ever since Joe Biden stood down as the Democrat presidential candidate, the moment people have been waiting for is the clash, the first US presidential debate between his replacement, Kamala Harris, and Donald Trump. And it takes place tonight in the city of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. What are those swing states to which both candidates have made repeated visits? Our correspondent Tom Bateman has been meeting voters in Western Philadelphia.
The coal train to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, once stopped here and helped fuel the growth of a superpower. From the vast steel mills here, they built modern America. But now most of the factories are rusting hulks that litter the riverside. And for many folks here, they still survive, but among the last of the left behind.
Well, I know that's 11-inch. I worked in there. That was, at the time, the most modern mill they had.
You were building America. You were building a whole country.
Kept, it just kept rolling off there.
Yeah, that steel would come off of there about 80 miles per hour. It would roll into corals like that. It was a fast mill, fastest mill in the area.
Jack and Wayne, men of steel. They worked here for years, and then the layoffs came.
It's just a shame that it went this way here. I mean, Johnstown, when things were going good, when I was working, there was 12,000 people worked here. Cleveland Steel was 12 miles long. Imagine 12 miles long from down in the end there.
Provided all the work.
Yeah, you thought he was going to be there till he retired, you know.
What do you think the answer to all this is now? Because you've got both Harris and Trump saying they want to reindustrialize, they want to bring back steel jobs, you know, they want to reinvest in the Rust Belt. Do you believe them?
I would believe Donald Trump. I don't believe Harris. She's been there 3.5 years and has done nothing. Now all of a sudden she's going to do something.
So I can tell which way you're going to vote.
Right, here's the hat, buddy.
Bit of a clue.
Yeah, I'm 100%. If it's an honest election, he'll win.
But I'm interested in what you say, because he had 4 years. He had 4 years he could have brought back.
We were energy independent when he was in there.
But we're still looking at this landscape where jobs have gone for years.
This was this way.
But nothing changed in his presidency then, so I'm just interested in why.
Yeah, I agree with you as far as this here, yeah.
But there's a lot of presidents around him and before him, but nothing's changed. I mean, this didn't happen overnight.
The election trail has been surging through Pennsylvania. It is now an intense focus of both campaigns. But just as this state's political split is between urban and rural, it is also unequally divided among men and women.
Thanks.
On their porch, from where they've watched Johnstown transform, I meet Kelly and Joseph. Joseph was wounded fighting in Afghanistan, and Kelly demands more help for veterans. But there's an area they don't agree on, where Donald Trump's record has become a vulnerability for him, especially among women.
And as far as that abortion thing, that's a woman's right. That is not up to the government to decide.
I don't believe in abortion.
I don't believe in it, but that is up to each individual, not the state or the government.
I'm walking along a disused railway line that runs alongside the old steel mills here. The track timbers are rotted now, and the rail itself, probably forged in this very plant here, is rusting. Donald Trump won this county by a landslide against Joe Biden in 2020. And again, he has rural Pennsylvania under his belt. For Kamala Harris to win, she has to hold on to the big cities and make ground, crucially, in the suburbs. And that is where the battle for Pennsylvania, this critical swing state, is now being fought.
Well, this is one of our regular work days that we've been having since the campaign started. Today we're doing postcards to Democrats who don't usually vote.
Paula Shrively has been organizing in Somerset County for years. Now she runs the local Democrats here, of a generation that's seen her state and her country reshaped. Pennsylvania hadn't backed a Republican for nearly three decades when it swung to Trump in 2016. Now she knows how close it is again.
If we could do 2% this year, we'd win. We wouldn't win here. We will never win here when it's 79%, 20% or whatever. We're never going to win here. But what we can do is help win statewide.
Can I leave you just a little thing with the PA Dems?
Street by street, door to door, they're out.
and Pennsylvania is being fought to the last zero of every zip code.
So every door that I knock on, I know that that is making a dent. It's making a difference.
It's a day off for petrol station pump fixer Bridget Jackson, who says she was compelled to the doorsteps to stop Donald Trump.
As the mother of two daughters, it's incredibly important that they have the right to choose what to do with their own bodies for the rest of their lives.
Back at the Riverside with the former steel worker Wayne, he says he'll be watching tonight's debate too. And then an answer that seems to resonate in this part of rural Pennsylvania. Can he be persuaded by the other side?
The Democrats at one time was for the working man. It's not that way anymore.
Why is that?
This socialist stuff. I mean, look at California. Just too much leniency. New York. I mean, why would anybody want to live in New York?
Discuss. Our correspondent Tom Bateman there. Meeting voters in Western Pennsylvania. It's 27 minutes past seven. Time for the sports news. Here's Delith.
Good morning, Nick. A first win for Wales under new boss Craig Bellamy played out in treacherous conditions in Montenegro. They won 2-1. And ahead of his 100th cap, Harry Kane says he's targeting 100 goals for his country. To cricket, and a promising summer for England ended in disappointment at the Oval as Sri Lanka won the third test by 8 wickets. I've been speaking to the former England captain, Michael Vaughan, and asked him whether that defeat was a blow following their previous 5 wins.
I don't think it's a huge blow. I hope it's a lesson for the players that Test cricket's hard. And you go to day two where they got themselves 261 for three. Harry Brook was batting nicely. Suddenly Sri Lanka had changed to this tactic of bowling wide outside the off stump to Harry Brook, and he fell into the trap, was caught extra cover, and then England lost all these wickets, were bowled out for 325. And then they went out into the field. It was almost as if they got 750 on the board with the fields that they had set. And then you go to day two, late on, and they bowled 17 overs of off-spin because of the light. Sri Lanka helped themselves to 69 runs and just eked away at that 325. It felt a bit casual. Some have said it's been a complacent performance, and I would agree with them. And at times, there was a trace of arrogance in terms of the way that they went out and tried to hit the ball to all parts. You know, it's Test match cricket. You are allowed to fight and leave the ball and just see through a spell or two from the bowlers. But England went back into their old ways of playing the baseball way. This summer, they've played baseball at the right times, but they've played defensively at the right time. They've dug in at the right times. So it's been an impressive summer because they've been able to go up and down in the gears, but almost a bit of a reminder of what was. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to play against the better teams, which they will do next year in 2025, India and Australia, I'm pretty sure I can guarantee that the mentality they had this week, if they arrive and play like that against India and Australia, they will get blown away.
I suppose some credit has to be given to Sri Lanka as well, particularly in their second innings with the bat. And what an innings as well from Pratham Nisanka.
Yeah, a very special innings. They like playing at the Oval. That's two Test match victories. Their head coach, Sanath Jayasuriya, was a part of the team that won here in 1998. So they like playing at the Oval. But it was a special 100. But I go back to the way that they bowled. England gave them 3 early wickets when they batted in the second innings. Sri Lanka started to dominate the game. And it actually took a special innings from Jamie Smith to get that chase up to 219. That was a special innings. He's the real find of the summer for England in Test match cricket. They have a really quality player, and he's the big plus of the summer. Yes, they've won 5 out of 6, but for me they've found an incredible player in Jamie Smith. But they can take great confidence in beating a good England side in their own backyard.
You mentioned next year, obviously a home series against India, followed by the Ashes against Australia. Before that, though, this autumn, England away to Pakistan and New Zealand. So what, therefore, will Brendan McCullum and his coaching team take into those next two Test series?
Well, I think this summer's been the first summer that we've not seen Broad and Anderson for many, many summers. Jimmy played that first test of the summer. That was his farewell game. And then since then, it's been the England bowling attack without the two legends of English cricket. And we've seen with Gus Axington that he looks a find. We've seen Josh Hull made his debut this week, 20 years old from Leicester, big left arm, quick bowler. He looks like a work in progress. But we saw here that the attack started to look a little bit tired. There was a few niggles clearly flying around. And when you go to next year against India and Australia, this bowling unit needs a little bit of backup. So Mark Wood's injury is a blow. Joffre Archer, they need to get him fit for next year because there's going to be bigger challenges ahead for this bowling attack against the likes of Virat Kohli and co, Steve Smith and co next year on decent wickets with the Kookaburra ball, particularly in Australia.
Michael, always great to get your thoughts. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you.
Former England captain Michael Vaughan speaking to me. Double Paralympic champion Maisie Newton-Smith joins me in the studio in an hour's time.
Dale, thank you very much indeed. Quick look at the weather today. It'll be windy and cool. Spells of rain in England and Wales will become increasingly confined to the south. Sunny spells and blustery showers for Scotland and Northern Ireland.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. It's 28 minutes to 8. Caroline Nicholls has the news.
About 1,700 offenders will be released early from prisons in England and Wales this morning as part of attempts to ease overcrowding. The scheme is designed to eventually make available up to 5,500 prison places. Downing Street has acknowledged that the move is difficult for the victims of crime, but says without it the justice system faces the prospect of not being able to lock criminals up. The Civil Defence Agency in Gaza says at least 40 people have been killed and more than 60 wounded in Israeli airstrikes on a safe zone where thousands of Palestinians were living in tents. Many more are reported to be buried at the site in the Al-Mawasi area of southern Gaza. The Israeli military said it had targeted a Hamas command centre. Figures released in the past half an hour show the rate of unemployment in the UK fell to 4.1% in the 3 months to July, compared with 4.2% in the previous quarter. The Office for National Statistics also said average earnings for the last quarter were up 4% annually. It means the full state pension will rise to £460 a year. MPs are to vote today on the government's decision to scrap universal winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners. 17 Labour MPs have signed a Commons motion calling the plan unpopular. Sir Keir Starmer says his government has been forced to make the decision because it inherited a poor financial situation. The Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, says pupils with special educational needs are overrepresented in those recorded as missing from school. Almost a quarter of those repeatedly absent have such requirements. The government has said it will look at how schools can better support students with special educational needs. The American actor James Earl Jones has died at the age of 93. In a career spanning 7 decades, he's best known for voicing Darth Vader in Star Wars, as well as his roles in the film Field of Dreams, Coming to America, and as Mufasa in The Lion King. He also regularly appeared on stage, winning 2 Tony Awards.
Thank you. It is 27 minutes to 8. There are many corners of the world where women and girls are severely oppressed, preventing them from enjoying the rights and the joys that men have in life. But the darkest of all those corners is at the moment Afghanistan. The BBC has been in Afghanistan in recent days and had rare access to women and girls reacting to a new set of laws that restricts their lives to an even more extraordinary extent than before. From Kabul, Yogita Limaya reports.
On previous visits, we've met with a psychologist who's talked to us about what she calls a pandemic of suicidal thoughts among Afghan women because of the restrictions on them. It's too risky for us to go to where she lives, so we're meeting in a separate, discreet location.
I'm experiencing one of the worst stress ever. My stomach has started so much issue. I've started having sleep issues. Even if they don't come to you and tell you that you have to cover your face, you don't have to like laugh or talk, but when they just go beside you, you just feel like shock. Your heartbeat gets up high. A lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of hopelessness.
You're a psychologist. You've been communicating with lots of people who talk to you about their mental health problems. But especially since the new law was passed, what are people telling you about what their state of mind is like?
When I talk to friends, to my students, colleagues, there is no hope. And it's better to die than to live in this situation. These are suicidal thoughts. It's getting a lot and a lot day by day.
Every time these incremental restrictions on women have been announced in Afghanistan, in the past, what we have seen is small groups of women marching on the streets, shouting slogans, asking for the right to study and the right to work. This time around, though, we have seen no demonstrations of those sort. We know the Taliban has clamped down on them. We've come to meet a woman who used to be a part of those protests. She has to move houses every few weeks for her safety. Because of the risks she's facing, it's taken quite a bit of time to figure out the logistics to try and even meet her safely. She asked for her voice to be changed so she wouldn't be identified.
I thought it was my duty to join the women who were protesting for our rights. The Taliban beat me and dragged me into a vehicle saying, "Why are you acting against us? This is an Islamic system." They took me to a dark, frightening place and insulted me with terrible words. We were treated like animals. After being released from detention, we weren't the same people we were before.
She broke down as she spoke. Now, Afghan women have been showing their dissent by posting videos of themselves online, singing songs criticizing the Taliban's actions. I've come to the Taliban government's media center. I'm here to meet the Taliban government's deputy spokesman, Hamdullah Fitrat, and I'm going to ask him about the new law.
There are people in your own country, there are even people who are working for your government who say that your interpretation of the Sharia is wrong, that the Sharia does not deny women basic rights. How can you justify a law that doesn't allow their voices to be heard in public?
The laws that have been introduced have been approved by the Supreme Leader in accordance with Islamic Sharia. Any religious scholar can check their references.
Most of the girls and women we've spoken to in your country say they are prepared to wear whatever it is that your government prescribes as long as you allow them to study. And because they're not being allowed to do that, they're being driven to the point of depression, even suicidal thoughts. Isn't it your responsibility as a government to listen to those voices and act on it?
Absolutely. Our sisters' education is an important issue. We are trying to resolve this, which is the demand of a lot of our sisters. We have mentioned it several times in the past too, that our leadership is working on it. A solution will be found.
It's been 3 years now since girls were locked out of schools. Do you really expect people to believe that you are committed to actually doing it?
We are awaiting the decision of our leadership.
Inshallah. It's been evident for a long time that there are divisions within the Taliban on the issue of women's education. And while for most women and teenage girls that means that they're blocked from getting an education, from college, from work of any sort. During our visits to this country, we have often heard that there are pockets where there are government-run efforts to include women specifically in the public health sector. And now we've been given exclusive access to something that usually stays running behind the scenes. I'm at a training course for midwives that's run by the Taliban Public Health Department. And all of the women in front of me, there are about a dozen of them. All of them are young women who appear to be in their 20s. My family feels proud of the work that I do. I'm happy to be able to serve the people of my country. 27-year-old Safiya told us. What I'm seeing in front of me, this is not likely to bring hope for a majority of women and teenage girls, but it is perhaps evidence that there are people within the Taliban government who are trying to enable the exceptions to the stringent laws where it's possible.
That was Yekatil Lemayeh reporting from Afghanistan. In the studio with me now, Dr. Ozala Nemat, who is an Afghan scholar and civil society activist. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Is there any realistic hope that the Taliban will change course?
The evidence shows that there isn't. Unfortunately, since they've taken over the country in August 2021, every day we have seen stricter policies from their leadership. And although, like your documentary also presented, no one is accepting these rules. They are not rules that are in accordance with Islam or in accordance with the Afghan culture and society, but they are Taliban rules. And that is a new, probably, terminology in the whole vocabulary of what is Islamic, what is not Islamic.
What should the outside world do now?
I think the outside world needs to realize the fact that this government is not legitimate in any way or form. And those who are trying to frame Afghanistan as a country that, okay, this is like the Taliban are Afghans and Afghans are ruling the Afghanistan and that's it, there is no international. That's a wrong kind of approach towards the country. So normalization of relationship with Taliban and engagement with Taliban in a way that accepts quietly and silently such kind of draconian rules is very dangerous.
Because there was a UN conference, wasn't there, earlier in the year, where there was a lot of criticism because they did accept the Taliban's rules in as much as Afghan women were not represented there.
Not only Afghan women, but not any non-Taliban Afghan was represented there. So even male Afghans, as journalists, as civil society, right, were not even in the room.
And the UN accepted those rules?
Yes.
Because UN it felt that it was the right thing to do, but you feel it wasn't?
No, I never feel it was the right thing to do, but UN and main countries, including the United States and other countries, they all accepted this.
What about things like sport? Because the England has said it's not going to have a bilateral series against Afghanistan. These are the men's teams, obviously, for as long as Afghanistan doesn't field a women's team. But Afghanistan is now taking part in international cricket. I mean, they're playing South Africa, of all nations, later in the month, which when you think of apartheid and all the rest of it, is horribly ironic, isn't it?
So it is ironic, but I mean, I have to say that cricket is one game that makes Afghans happy still. Like when we win against major countries, like, you know, several countries that are known for being like the champions of cricket historically, that brought a lot of joy and happiness in the Afghan minds.
So should an exception be made for cricket and cricket still be paid against
Afghans? Well, I mean, these are the kind of things that we need to be very careful about. If the cricket team maintains its identity as an Afghan team with an Afghan flag, with an Afghan identity that is away from Taliban identity, which are like enforcing their own like these kind of restrictions and rules that are not acceptable, then it's okay. But if it comes and brings in one day the flag of Taliban in the international grounds, it will be, I'm sure every single one of the cricket fans will go against it and will not accept it. So international community should follow the example of Olympics. We had in Paralympics and in Olympic Games, Afghan girls represented the same as Afghan men. And that has to be modeled in every other, sports area and any other area.
Dr. Ozala Nema, thank you very much for coming this morning.
The time now is 17 minutes to 8.
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No, I... I am your father.
I am your father. The unmistakable voice there of James Earl Jones, the actor who's died at the age of 93. That from the movie The Empire Strikes Back. Now, earlier this morning, I spoke with Jeannie Wolfe, the West Coast editor of the Saturday Evening Post and a reporter in Hollywood. And I began by wishing her a very good morning from London.
It's a very great day here in Los Angeles, but a little sadness because one of our best actors, James Earl Jones, died today. And people may not recognize that name, but believe me, they'll recognize the voice.
Not least because of Star Wars.
Oh, Star Wars. He was Darth Vader, and there were lots of secrets around that. Interestingly enough, George Lucas said at first he envisioned Orson Welles in the part, and then he thought, no, he's too known. And so he called James Earl Jones' agent, and it was one of the things that put Jones on the map. You know, everyone knew the voice of Darth Vader. And, you know, people would not just ask him for autographs, but they would try to get as many secrets as they could about Star Wars and the next movies that would come out.
Another thing that almost literally put him on the map was being the voice of CNN, the voice of American news around the globe, heard in so many hotels all those years ago when it began.
Yes, this is CNN. No, no, no. He does it much better than that. But I think of him every day, and I thought of him today listening to that. This is CNN. And he got quite a kick out of that. He was a big guy with a big voice, 6'2", 200 pounds, very imposing guy, very serious, and also a lot of fun. Very charming, very wonderful to be around.
But more than a voice, a great actor, too.
Oh, I would say one of our best actors. He was in the Joseph Papp Shakespeare Company, and I saw him play Othello. The power in him. He was a great actor, and he was very serious about acting, because when he was 8 years old, he had such a bad stutter that he didn't even talk for a couple years. And then, with sheer willpower, he taught himself to speak again. He was very proud of that, but he also thought it helped make him a better actor because he prized the word so much.
Now, he wasn't given an Oscar for any part he played, was he?
He was nominated for The Great White Hope, but he got an honorary Oscar.
Which was a sign, what, of Hollywood wanting to give him the respect they thought he deserved?
Absolutely. Over 80 films and TV shows and Broadway, he certainly was one of the people in the crowd in this town that other actors respected, looked up to, and maybe were a little intimidated by. I interviewed him many times, and I found him very interesting and lots of fun. He also had a great sense of humor. Don't forget, he played the king in the Eddie Murphy movie twice, Coming to America. He always said that he wasn't a writer, and what gave him pleasure was the wonderful stories people brought to him, and that he could bring these stories alive, affect people and teach people. And he said the stories entertained him and also broke his heart.
Jeannie Wolfe, thank you for paying tribute to James Earl Jones, who's died at the age of 93.
And that brings us to 30 minutes to 8. And for Thought for the Day, the speaker this morning, here in the studio, Giles Fraser, the vicar of St Anne's Church, Kew. Good morning, Giles.
Good morning to you. God Save the King was first sung at London's Drury Lane Theatre in 1745 in response to the Jacobite victory at Preston Pans. Some versions of the national anthem include the lines, "May he sedition hush, and like a torrent rush, rebellious Scots to crush, God save the King." Now you can see why some would have a problem singing that. The new interim England football manager doesn't sing the national anthem for different reasons. He says it disrupts his pre-match preparation. And with England playing again tonight, no doubt the questions on that one will continue. Personally, I'm a committed royalist who's more than happy to sing God Save the King, as we did in church on Sunday to mark the anniversary of King Charles's accession. But I do get why the constituent nations of the Union might also want a national anthem of their own as well. The Scots have Flower of Scotland, the Welsh have Land of My Fathers, and the Northern Irish sometimes use Londonderry Air. But the English don't really have even a semi-official one. One candidate might be Jerusalem. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? Well, actually, no, they didn't. But as with all things by William Blake, we need to allow a high degree of poetic license. And the idea that an idealised Jerusalem, the heavenly city, might be builded here among the dark satanic mills is for me a rather compelling evocation of peace and justice being made present in the place where I live, in England's green and pleasant land. But in a diverse, multicultural country such as this, with believers and non-believers, royalists and republicans, I can see why some might have a problem with this too. Indeed, any big story we tell about ourselves is probably going to upset someone. Some years ago, that other rebellious Scot, Billy Connolly, jokingly suggested that we should use the theme tune of The Archers. Bum ba bum ba bum ba bum bum ba bum ba bum bum. You could argue that the advantage of having a national anthem without words might be that no one can be offended by it. But my worry is that if we give up on the attempt to say something about who we are, who we want to be, then in the end we'll become little more than a collection of individuals. And the whole point of a national anthem is to indicate that we is greater than I. Indeed, the former chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, of blessed memory and formerly of this parish on Thought for the Day, would often say that the very essence of biblical morality was the shift from I to we. So whether by reference to God or the king or some other aspect aspect of our national story. This sense of collective solidarity absolutely seems to me to be a valuable thing to sing about.
And that was Thought for the Day with Giles Fraser. The time, 10 to 8.
The cancer journey is complex, scary and unpredictable for everyone, especially those closest to you. With humility, it also brings you face to face with your own vulnerabilities in a way you've never considered before. And with that, a new perspective on everything.
By speaking publicly about her cancer, her treatment and the lasting effect it's had on her, the Princess of Wales will once again no doubt have helped many living with a disease that was once considered to be literally unmentionable, referred to only by that phrase, the C word. We're joined by two of those who know the impact cancer can have, who watched that video that was released by the Princess of Wales yesterday. Erin Kennedy, who's just won gold at the Paralympics in Paris, as Cox in the mixed four rowing events, who was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was just 29 years old, months after winning gold in Tokyo back in 2021, and also by Alistair James, father of Dame Deborah James, who received that honour for her services to charity and cancer awareness after hosting the podcast You, Me and the Big C. She died in 2022. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Nick.
Erin, as a cancer sufferer, how did you respond to the princess's words?
I think she was, unsurprisingly, incredibly articulate about the complexities of this very odd sort of phase where you've had a diagnosis, you've had active treatment, and now you're trying to figure out almost what happens next. And I think it's something that's quite unspoken about. And I think it's a fantastic thing that she's essentially bringing to the public consciousness, that a little bit like when the pandemic finished, we didn't snap our fingers and go back to normal. We were trying to figure out what happens next. And, you know, she's entering that phase of her treatment journey, which a lot of people do, whether they are stage four or one of the earlier stages with hope of a cure, that you then have to navigate sort of life after and with cancer. And that's a real challenge.
Because there are lasting physical as well as psychological effects of the treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I finished chemotherapy in December 22. I still really suffer with fatigue. My fertility is only just starting to get back onto its feet. And, you know, that's not to mention all the kind of medical hangovers you have when you have had something kind of as significant in your life as cancer as well.
Alistair James, Deborah, of course, raised the awareness in such a moving way. You must feel, in a way, that Catherine, the Princess of Wales, is continuing that work.
Yes, and I think we've found out over the importance of public speakers and public people, and people have the chance to share with the public parts of their journey. That really plays a very important role of raising the awareness of cancer, making more people think about it. As you say, it no longer becomes that hidden C word. You know, as when I was growing up, because I'm now approaching my 70s, you know, it was something tucked away in a cupboard. Now more and more people are prepared to talk about it. And sadly, we know from Cancer Research UK that there could be up to 900,000 people maybe dying from cancer over the next 5 years.
I noticed that she also spoke, Alistair, didn't she, about the impact on others, the impact on the people who love you. I know plenty of cancer sufferers who afterwards, and possibly with the benefit of hindsight after recovery, say it was tougher on those close to me than it was on me in a strange way.
It is tough on everybody who's involved in it in different ways. It could be friends. I mean, one of the difficulties people have is, how do we talk about it? How do you approach the person on it? You know, what help can I give them? I mean, because sometimes many cancer sufferers will say, just help me get on with my life and do good things with me and be there to support me and share it with me. And then everybody chooses in their own mind how they're going to share it and to what extent. I think it's been great that the princess has been allowed to tell people what she's been going through, but then primarily has been left alone, which is perfect.
Erin, did you feel, when you look back at your treatment, that it was particularly difficult for people around you who didn't know what you were going through, who found the words hard to understand when you tell them you're suffering?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons that I ended up actually being very public and very open about everything I was going through was there was kind of multifaceted. One was to really raise awareness that cancer can happen, and it can happen when you're young, fit and healthy. But also it was partly to almost give people the words, because that is something that's really difficult. People don't know how to talk to you about it. They don't know what's okay. And so I almost did that for them. I shared everything, and then that was kind of open for discussion. If they wanted to have a discussion, I kind of left nothing off limits. And that is something that's really personal, and something that ended up being really cathartic for me. So I shared everything from, you know, the niche side effects of chemo through to my fertility journey. And yeah, it was partly to kind of bring it into the public consciousness and bring it into the conversation, but also actually to directly help the people around me, because particularly when you're going through something like chemotherapy, when the treatment process is actually really long, you know, you just want normality. You just want to be able to carry on as normal, and almost you don't want cancer to be the first part of the conversation. And I think the princess was really articulate there, just talking about how it does impact your loved ones, because actually they don't want to always be talking about it too. And it's occupying their headspace all the time. So just leaving them to go and do other things and be free to kind of live their lives as well is pretty important.
And Alistair, your presence here this morning is evidence that you, in Deborah's family, are determined to keep up her work.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I think, as Erin says, about sharing it with people. One of the reasons Deborah started sharing it with people was so she only had to tell the story once. She almost started her blogs and podcasts and saying, it's out there, now you can find out.
Yeah, it's a substitute for people endlessly asking you, isn't it?
Yes, and she said, you know, it's there. Of course there's stuff going underneath, and there's stuff that only the family see. There's stuff only her husband saw. And, you know, she tried to protect us at times, but, you know, it's very difficult to. And you sit there sometimes as part of the family, so frustrated that you can't do more. Whatever you have said before, you just think, what can I do to take it away? You know, in reality, the princess is now carrying on with her next stage. And, you know, she will then go through the periods, maybe if there is a scan coming up, all cancer payments know the anxiety when those dates come up, and the dates get further apart. But the worry about, has it gone? Is it going to come back? What is that niggle?
And that
really is, you need the support.
Father of Dame Deborah James, Erin Kennedy, thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
A couple of minutes to eight is the time. Simon King has the weather.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. Yeah, we've got some rain moving its way southward today across the UK. It's going to be a blustery day with some frequent showers towards northern and western parts as well. Strong winds in particular across Scotland. But for southern areas of England, it's pretty cloudy at the moment. So we'll see a few breaks in the cloud in the southwest before rain starts to move its way in later on into the evening, really. It's been quite breezy, temperatures of 16 to 18 degrees. Elsewhere across England and Wales, we've got that rain moving its way southward at the moment across northern areas of England. Quite heavier for a time. It moves southward, and then there'll be some sunny spells developing, a few showers towards the north and the west, and again quite windy conditions and feeling quite cool with temperatures of 12 to 15 Celsius. And then for Northern Ireland and across Scotland, rain is sinking southward. There'll be some sunny spells, especially for Northern Ireland, southern and eastern Scotland. But in the north and northwest of Scotland, this is where we're going to have the most frequent showers moving in, some hail, some thunder and strong winds, particularly for the Northern Isles, with gales expected here today, and maximum temperatures getting to about 9 to 12 Celsius.
Simon, thank you.
On BBC iPlayer.
I'm on a train. It's the Glasgow to London night sleeper service.
Brand new drama.
I think we may have a problem.
There's been a hack check-in. Hijacks are so 20th century.
We're being controlled remotely.
This train is now a guided missile.
One of the passengers may be working with the hackers. Don't trust anyone.
You're never getting off, are we?
Night Sleeper departs on Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
And coming up in the next hour on this programme, Germany is going to challenge its EU partners and push back illegal migrants from next Monday on all of its borders. Why are they doing that now?
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 10th of September. The headlines this morning, 1,700 prisoners are being released early today as part of an emergency plan to ease overcrowding. An Israeli airstrike has hit a safe zone in southern Gaza, killing more than 40 people. Israel said it was targeting a Hamas command center. MPs will give their verdict on Sir Keir Starmer's plan to stop winter fuel payments for 10 million pensioners. And the American actor James Earl Jones, the voice of Darth Vader, has died at the age of 93. The BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The government has begun releasing offenders early from jails in England and Wales to try to ease overcrowding. Around 1,700 inmates are expected to be freed today as part of a scheme intended to make available up to 5,500 prison places. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said ministers had taken every measure available to protect the public, but concerns have been expressed about offender rehabilitation and ensuring victims are safe. Here's our Home and Legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
Today's release has immediately reduced the prison population in England and Wales and create breathing space for prison officers who say they are battling to keep institutions safe. The scheme to release offenders on licence after they've spent 40% of their sentence locked up excludes those convicted of sexual offences, domestic abuse crimes and serious violence, but it's not without risks. Those released will spend their first day of freedom meeting probation officers and learning of their licence restrictions. But despite almost 2 months of planning, it's unclear whether they'll all have a place to sleep. Rehabilitation charities fear many will struggle to find work because they have not finished prison courses in time. There's little opposition to the scheme at Westminster, as the plans were drawn up by the Conservatives earlier this year. But Charlie Taylor, the Chief Inspector of Prisons, has said the government must now take sustained, decisive action to make life safer within jails and protect communities when people are released.
Martin Jones, who's the Chief Inspector of Probation, told this programme that the early release plan had placed staff under extra pressure to find accommodation for all those coming out of jail.
In any given period, about 1 in 7 people released from prison are homeless. And what you're seeing this week is nearly 2,000 people being released. That's nearly twice the number that would ordinarily be released in any given week. That's placing significant pressure on the probation service and the people that provide the accommodation underpinning that.
Gaza's civil defence agency says an Israeli attack near the southern city of Khan Yunis has killed 40 people and wounded dozens. The strike hit Al-Mawasi, which was designated a safe zone by the Israeli military early in the war. Thousands of displaced Palestinians have taken refuge there. Israel said it was targeting a Hamas command centre. Joe Floto sent this report from Jerusalem.
Residents describe how, shortly after midnight, explosions sent huge fireballs into the night sky above Al-Mawasi, a designated humanitarian zone in the southwest of the Gaza Strip, housing thousands of displaced families in tents or improvised shelters, none of which would have afforded much protection from the blast. One witness described to the BBC how he and other volunteers rushed to the site of the explosion, only to find 3 large craters where once a group of 20 tents had stood. The Israeli military said it was targeting what it called significant Hamas terrorists operating a command and control centre in the humanitarian zone. It claimed it had taken numerous steps to mitigate the risk of harming civilians.
MPs will vote later today on government plans to restrict the winter fuel payment to all but the poorest pensioners. Last night, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, met Labour backbenchers in an attempt to quell dissent about the money-saving move. She said it was the result of what she called reckless decisions the Conservatives made while in office. Separately, Sir Keir Starmer is due to warn the Trades Union Congress that more tough decisions are on the way. This report from our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
This winter, around 10 million pensioners will no longer receive the winter fuel payment. Sir Keir Starmer's huge majority means that today's vote won't change that. 17 Labour MPs have signed a motion calling for the cut to be postponed, but ministers insist it has to happen now to make savings in this financial year. They say they have no plans to offer any further support, pointing to the £900 increase in the state pension since last year. At a meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party last night, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, urged Labour MPs not to abstain, calling on them to stand, lead and govern together. When he addresses union leaders at the Trade Union Congress in Brighton, the Prime Minister will warn that there are more tough decisions on the horizon. The government's hoping it can show unity in taking such moves ahead of the budget in October.
The Labour and Cooperative MP Rachel Maskell told us she plans to abstain in the vote as part of efforts to change the policy.
I want to work with Labour to find the mitigation which is going to be absolutely necessary to keep the cold from older people. Of course, they've got the hardest budgets of all to balance as they make the decision how they keep themselves warm. And I want to ensure that they get the protection they need this winter, that they're warm and well, and that they ultimately know that the government is providing that protection.
New figures show that average earnings in the UK for the 3 months to July were up by 4% annually. It means that under the triple lock system, the full new state pension is expected to rise by £460 a year. More details from our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
This morning's figures reveal how the triple lock for pensioners will apply this year, increasing the payments well above inflation. As average earnings, including bonuses, increased by 4% between May and July, that should mean a £460 a year increase in the full new state pension to £11,962 from April. This comes on top of a £900 increase this year. The number is officially confirmed by the Work and Pension Secretary, Liz Kendall, before next month's budget and after the inflation figures, set to be just over 2%, are confirmed next month. Pre-2016 retirees on the previous state pension will also see a 4% rise in line with earnings, but a smaller cash increase depending on their years of eligibility. The Chancellor last night pointed towards this figure and the promise to protect the triple lock for the duration of this Parliament when facing Labour MPs concerned about the means testing of winter fuel payments.
The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in London for talks with the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary and other senior figures. America's top diplomat is making his first visit to Britain since Labour came to power in July, and it comes ahead of Sir Keir Starmer's meeting with President Biden at the end of the week. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, looks at what they'll discuss and where there could be differences.
The war in Ukraine, the elusive ceasefire in Gaza, and Russia's ability to evade Western sanctions. There is much to discuss between the Western world's closest allies, and Antony Blinken's visit is being hailed by Whitehall as the reaffirmation of a close partnership under the banner of a strategic dialogue. But beneath the surface, there are differences. Washington is more cautious than its ally when it comes to allowing Ukraine to fire long-range missiles into Russia. On Israel, too, there are varying views. This Labour government has shocked Israelis by introducing a partial suspension of arms exports. It coincided with the discovery of six Israeli hostages executed by their Hamas captors in Gaza. But overall, Britain and America have more to agree on than not. Their close relationship continues.
The former leader of the UK Independence Party, Geoffrey Tytford, has died. He was 90. Geoffrey Tytford was one of three UKIP MEPs elected to the European Parliament in 1999. He became the party's leader the following year. Before joining UKIP, he'd served as a Conservative councillor in Clacton, but ended his association with the Tories in 1992. The acclaimed American actor James Earl Jones, who used his booming, distinctive voice to bring Darth Vader to life in the Star Wars films, has died at the age of 93. His career, spanning several decades, was littered with accolades, including 2 Tony Awards, 2 Emmys, a Grammy and an Honorary Academy Award. He was a star of stage, television and film, but as our arts correspondent David Sillitoe reports, it's his voice for which he'll be warmly remembered.
The voice of Darth Vader. This alone guaranteed James Earl Jones a place in Hollywood history, but when Star Wars first came out, he didn't even appear in the credits. However, it was just one of dozens of roles. His remarkable voice can be heard in The Lion King.
One day, Simba, the sun will set on my time here.
And even a famous news sting.
This is CNN, a network of Turner Broadcasting System.
But as a teenager, he refused to speak.
I was a mute until I was about 14 because I'm a stutterer. I still am a stutterer. And when I learned how to work around that stutter, I learned the great beauty in those who could speak.
It was drama that helped him find his voice after the traumas of his Mississippi childhood and led to a successful stage career at a time when there were few black actors on Broadway. He is one of a select number with an Emmy, a Grammy, an Honorary Oscar and a Tony. There was rather more to him than just the voice of one of cinema's great villains.
I am the Father.
David Sillitoe reporting.
Thank you. 8:10 is the time. What a day for His Majesty's Inspector of Prisons to publish his annual report. That report asking the simple question, if we use prisons to warehouse people in squalor, surrounded by drugs and violence and failing to address their unmet mental health needs, what can we really expect when they are released? Well, we are about to find out about a particular cohort of released prisoners soon enough, because today is the day that the prison doors open for 1,700 or so of them, let out to relieve the system, thousands more to follow soon. Charlie Taylor, the Chief Inspector of Prisons, is here in the studio, and so is Sean Williams, who's the CEO of Switchback, which is a charity that helps young men find a way out of the justice system once they get out of prison. Good morning to you both. And Sean Williams, I start with you. How worried are you about what happens today? How prepared are you as a charity?
As a charity, we're very prepared. As a system, we're not particularly prepared, unfortunately. And that's really about pressuring the system. When someone leaves prison, what they need is a stable place to sleep. They need access to benefits. They need someone who's going to train or employ them. And our system isn't set up for that. We've got far too places for people to sleep and be safe and to be able to go from that place, go out and work and live.
Yeah, because we were hearing from the Chief Inspector of the probation system earlier in the programme. There are people who are going to be released today, probably, who won't have anywhere to sleep tonight.
And last year, 7 in 10 people that we worked with were released homeless. That doesn't necessarily mean there isn't an address on a form that someone says they're going to go and sleep at. But in truth, either they can't go to that place because they're not welcome there, or when they get there, it's unsafe. We often find that people are evicted on a Friday. We're running around trying to find people access to safe housing. And if they've just started a job, or they've just started a training programme, or they've just started to work on their mental health, being evicted or the fear of eviction and knowing what that means for them probably means ending up back in prison at some point.
Right.
Is terrifying.
And that is a strain on a system that already exists. How much extra strain comes this week then?
For the whole system, a lot of strain. The difference now is that we're getting more time to work. So the fact that we made this decision collectively, you know, the system has made a decision quite some time ago that this is going to happen.
Yeah, because it was under the Conservative government, wasn't it, that they decided to do this and Labour stuck with it?
Yeah, and we've had at least kind of 10 weeks to start getting ready and 6 weeks knowing people's names that we can start working with them. That doesn't mean the housing is there. It just means that we've had longer to start work.
What has to happen, in your view, once this week is over and people think about these things, or maybe don't think about them enough? What do you like to see?
The only way we're going to get the prison population down is to reduce reoffending and recall. The way we're going to get that is a commitment that everyone leaving prison has housing, not just for 6 weeks as we currently theoretically have, but for at least 3 months. Access to benefits from day one, and a named person who's alongside them, such a Switchback, but it might be another charity or a family member who's going to be their sponsor and really support them through the very difficult transition back into society.
Sean Williams, thank you. Let's turn to Charlie Taylor, Chief Inspector of Prisons, who's sitting alongside you. How worried are you, Ms. Taylor, about today?
Well, of course, it's concerning. We highlight in our reports frequently the lack of preparation that's done for people leaving prison anyway. It takes quite a lot of work to get someone ready to leave prison. They need to have somewhere to live, as Sean has said. They need to be access to things like mental health, to drug, substance misuse services. And that preparation has to start a long time in advance. Now, normally about 1,000 people a week come out from prison, and those 1,000 people will be coming out anyway this week. But on top of that, we have an extra 1,700 today, where we already know that probation services are very much under strain, particularly in some parts of the country.
Should it be happening?
Well, the government had no choice. The bath was overflowing and they had to turn the taps off, or they had to let the water out. And inevitably, they had to let some prisoners go, particularly with the rioters coming in over the last few weeks. We were just completely running out of space.
They tell us that people convicted of sexual offences, domestic abuse, crimes, serious violence will not be among those released. But it is plain, isn't it, that some people who have committed violent offences will be, and some people who potentially have committed domestic offences but actually not been charged as a domestic crime, but still a crime of violence against a woman, that they too will be out.
Yes, certainly. There is no doubt that some of the people who are coming out are risky. And by the prison service's own definition, a fair proportion of people coming out will be designated as high risk of harm. And therefore, these are the people who need the most preparation. They need community services to be ready to look after them when they come out. They need to have licence conditions set and in place, and they need somewhere stable to live.
And we were hearing earlier from the Chief Inspector of Probation that actually those licence conditions and the likelihood that some people break those conditions means that some of these people could well be back in prison quite soon, if indeed there are other spaces to have them.
Without doubt. With the government's last early release scheme, we inspected prisons on the Monday, saw someone leaving the prison, and they were back in the jail on the Wednesday. I suspect there will be some cases of that, even as we speak.
Are you worried for victims of violence who are, in some cases, saying that they have not been contacted as they should have been? In other words, has it put an extra strain on a system that anyway sometimes has difficulty in contacting everyone who ought to be contacted?
Yes, indeed. And that is part of the preparation that should be done in advance of people leaving custody. But because it's had to be done very quickly, because there are very large numbers of people coming out, it is inevitable that there will be some cracks in the system. And we have to hope that that those people do get back into society and they don't go on to commit further offences.
On the wider question of the state of our prisons, you say in your report that the government needs to take sustained, decisive action to make life safer within prisons. What does that look like? What does that action look like in, I don't know, the coming year?
Well, the first thing is about drugs and the availability of drugs in prison, which is getting higher and higher. We report on HMP Hindley, just outside Wigan, where 52% of prisoners are testing positive in random tests for drugs. Now, the idea that if that many drugs are getting into a prison, that is a rehabilitative environment is simply fanciful. So the first thing is security measures to make sure drugs don't get in, but also reducing the demand for drugs within prison as well. And that means treatment for prisoners who are drug users, but also giving prisoners a sense of hope, giving prisoners the sort of purposeful activity that makes them feel they're moving on with their sentence. And also they have the skills and the attributes to be able to resettle successfully when they come out. But all too often in prisons we inspect, we find prisoners banged up in their cells, sometimes for up to 22 hours a day, often in overcrowded and unsanitary conditions. While at the same time, we find classrooms that are empty, we find workshops that are empty, and education and training simply isn't given the priority that it should within our prisons.
What do you need to hear then from the government about, which I mean, I imagine if a minister were here, they'd be saying, well, yes, we agree, basically, that all of these things should have happened. They haven't happened under previous governments, etc. What, in terms of financial commitment, given all the other things that there are, that are difficult and tight at the moment, what can we as a society, I suppose, legitimately expect from a government when it comes to increasing the spending that would then provide some of the things you've just talked about?
Well, it costs £50,000 a year on average to keep someone locked up. And there has to be a question about, even with that money, whether we're getting value for money with the reoffending rates that we see with people leaving custody. But we also see things like crumbling prison infrastructure. Almost every prison I go to, I trip over cables because there are generators that have had to be put into place, that gas systems aren't working properly. So much of the infrastructure, particularly in our crumbling Victorian jails, it is really just not fit for purpose. And those tend to be the prisons that are the most crowded and often have some of the riskier men in them.
Charlie Taylor and earlier Sean Williams, thank you both very much.
It's 18 minutes past 8. Just look ahead to 8 o'clock tonight here on Radio 4, when Michelle's going to be joined by a panel of guests on the Today debate. The guests will include George Clark and Robert Halfon to discuss the damning findings of the public inquiry into the Grenfell Tower fire. We'll be asking what it will take to see change and create a building safety system that works. That's the Today debate tonight at 8 on Radio 4, and of course after that on BBC Sounds. Now, the government will not risk its mandate for economic stability under any circumstances. That is Keir Starmer's stern message today to trade unions meeting at the TUC conference. It appears to be a message directed not just at them when they argue for more pay rises, but also to Labour MPs contemplating whether to rebel over the government's plans to cut winter fuel allowance for 10 million pensioners. We're joined from Westminster by the Business and Trade Secretary, Jonathan Reynolds. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
Do you in government accept there's a real danger some pensioners will die of cold this winter under a Labour government?
No, we are making sure, first of all, that we can reassure people by saying that the state pension this year is higher than last winter and energy bills are lower than last winter. And our commitment to the triple lock means that throughout this Parliament, pensioners will be better off. And also alongside that, we're targeting, as you know, support at the people who need it the most. Not just making sure people who are eligible for pension credit continue to receive winter fuel payments, but the people who are eligible for pension credit itself and are not getting it are going to get it under our plans to drive that up. And then there are other things, the Household Support Fund, the Warm Homes Discount as part of that. So we are acknowledging, yes, this is a difficult decision. We didn't want to have to make it, but we're making sure the protections are in place. But I would say, acknowledge openly, Nick, we didn't want to have to make this decision. But what we've inherited, that black hole, is real. It affects real things that were in my department that are very dear to the British public, like compensation for postmasters or money for the steel industry. And that commitment to responsibility is not just a difficult message to deal with a problem. It's about providing the foundation.
Well, let's talk about the reality for pensioners. 100,000 could be pushed into poverty, says the anti-poverty charity, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Not least because, as you well know, there are at least 1 million pensioners who are poor, for whom higher fuel bills do push them into poverty, but do not receive pension credit. So you can't with any assurance say they'll be protected, can you?
No, I recognise what you have just told me in terms of the figures and the challenge that represents. First of all, a commitment to a higher state pension for everybody is important. I mean, we've obviously seen the rise of £900 this year. I think we can reasonably say we'd expect it to rise by earnings next year, so that would be around £400.
But specifically, £400 you give with one hand and you take £300 off with the other. And if you're on the lowest basic state pension of around about £9,000 a year, a little bit more than that, that loss of £300 is hugely significant.
Well, if you were on that amount of money, let's just be clear and reassure the public, you would be eligible for pension credit. You would therefore still receive the winter fuel payment.
If you're just above it, you would not receive that money.
There is a cohort of people who for a long time have been eligible for pension credit who haven't received it. I can tell you this morning that applications for pension credit are up 115% in the last 5 weeks. So we are making good on our promise to make sure people who get that benefit make sure they receive that in itself.
Sure, but are you ruling out help for the 1 million people? Don't, if you wouldn't mind, don't say it again because you've said it already. So given that I'm focusing on 1 million people in fuel poverty above that level, will you listen to Andy Burnham when he says on the programme earlier he urges you not to rule out giving extra help to those people? He understands why you're making the change. Rachel Maskell, Labour MP, planning to abstain tonight. Why won't you signal a willingness to look at that group?
Well, first of all, I think that is an important group and a vulnerable group, but that is why we have extended the Household Support Fund. So that's a discretionary fund. It's just worth slightly short of £500 million that allows discretionary targeted support around that. So I recognise that cohort, but I say you put these things together, the triple lock, the commitment to pension credit, the continuation of winter fuel payments for that cohort of people, the Household Support Fund, the Warm Homes Discount, that is in place. But I will say
openly, you've just
and
mentioned a fund that's worth 50p each. If there's 1 million people above pension credit and you're giving £500,000 help, that's 50p each. I mean, this isn't a serious attempt to do it. Every Chancellor since 2010 has been given the idea of scrapping winter fuel payments for everyone but the poorest. Every single one, and I might point out all of them Conservatives, ended up rejecting the idea when they looked at it. Why has it taken a Labour government promising change and hope to embrace this idea?
Because every single one of those Conservative chancellors contributed to a significant black hole in the public finances, contributed to a lack of fiscal responsibility. We should be angry at them, not angry at the people coming in as the team to fix the foundations of this country and make sure we've got that prosperity in future. We cannot.
Why not tax the wealthy, as Sharon Graham of the Unite Union suggested to the TUC yesterday and suggested on this programme yesterday? You've got a choice. You didn't have to hit pensioners, you could have hit the wealthy.
We did have to take a really difficult choice. It's not a choice we wanted to have to make, but as I say, we tried to reassure people that additional support is in place to do that. But when I talk about the black hole, right, that's not abstract. That is things that
matter
to the
rich people. Forgive me, why not hit the wealthy, Mr. Reynolds?
They want to make sure the government fixes and adheres to its promises on, whether that's, for me, compensation to postmasters or money for the future of the steel industry or whole range of...
I don't think the line's gone. I've asked you three times, why not hit the wealthy?
Well, we have a budget coming up, but we have made clear that taxes, in terms of what we've inherited, are already high on working people. And when people say, you know, there's an easy answer to these things, there isn't. Yeah. The first line of Labour's manifesto was a commitment to responsibility, that people could trust us with the public finances, and they can.
I tell you, the word that was on the front cover of that manifesto, it was change, Mr. Reynolds, and you talked of hope. Is this what you meant when you talked of change?
What is important to recognise is the hope that we want to deliver for people, the better times ahead. You need responsibility and a firm foundation to build that on. I think where we will have to make sure people understand us is that when we talk about fixing the foundations, that's not just about fixing problems that we've inherited in the near term. It's about a better house in future, a better future. And you have to have the responsibility with the public finances that is necessary to do that. We have seen in the past, Conservative governments spend vast amounts of money, frankly, on their own failure. We don't want that, but we have to recognise what we've inherited, quite frankly, from the Conservative Party is a disgrace. People are right to be angry about that, but we've got to be the team that fixes it because we're the only people who can do that.
Jonathan Reynolds, Business and Trade Secretary, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
25 past eight to the sport, Dennis Lloyd.
Justin, good morning again. Craig Bellamy says his first win as Wales manager was played in the hardest conditions he can remember. Despite torrential rain in Montenegro, Wales won 2-1 thanks to early goals from Kiefer Moore and Harry Wilson. Harry Kane says he's targeting 100 goals for his country as he prepares to win his 100th cap this evening. He already has 66 goals. The England captain will be presented with a golden cap before kick-off at Wembley. And former England captain Michael Vaughan has told me England were a little bit complacent and at times a trace of arrogance in their performance as they lost the third test to Sri Lanka by 8 wickets at the Oval. Now, I'm pleased to say joining me in the studio this morning is double Paralympic champion Maisie Newton-Smith, one of the stars of the Great Britain team in Paris. Maisie, great to have you with us. Congratulations, you're back on home soil. How does it feel to be back?
Fabulous, yeah. Paris was amazing. Utterly brilliant. And to be back home now and celebrate with my family is going to be really special, but I am quite tired now. It's been a long few weeks. So I'm ready to kind of relax, recover, but also, yeah, take time to celebrate the past few weeks.
Yeah, because I suppose it hasn't even really sunk in yet that you've won another two gold medals.
No, definitely not. I think, you know, you're in such a high elite athlete environment, always focusing on the performance and what you can do next. So yeah, coming home, I think it will take a few days to sink in. But yeah, no, that's just all part of the experience. And yeah, it's all amazing.
And what was it like going into Paris, knowing you had two titles from Tokyo to defend? How was that pressure?
Yeah, there was a lot of pressure there. And I don't know if that's external pressure or pressure I put on myself, really. You know, I'm quite deep down, I am quite a competitive person, and I always want to maintain my title and keep at the kind of top level of my sport. So I think, you know, going in, I really wanted to defend my titles. But with me, you never know quite what the other girls that I race do. And, you know, some of the girls are quite fast. So for me, I think that's where the pressure was. But it was just about believing myself, talking to my coach, and yeah, having that great support network around me to get the best performance out of myself.
And I can imagine the huge crowds inside the La Défense Arena were in complete contrast to the no crowds in Tokyo because of the pandemic.
Yeah, it was crazy. I remember, you know, we have like team meetings before we go out, before we start our competition, and the team managers kind of said, you know, there could be 15,000 people watching us. And for us, you know, as para swimming, we hardly have that when we're racing at home. So we probably have a maximum of 100 to 200 people sometimes. So to have 15,000 people, it was really, really special. And the main part was my family really being there in the crowd.
Absolutely. And what a performance by the whole Great Britain team. 124 medals in total, 30 of those won in the pool, 18 of them swimming golds. What an achievement.
Yeah, it's fantastic, you know, and it's all through the support we get through Paralympics GB, the National Lottery. None of us would be where we are today without the support that we have from those guys. So, yeah, we can't thank them enough. And I think with them as well, you know, it's the support of our family. They're the ones that get us there every single day, driving us to training. So yeah, without that whole support network, we definitely wouldn't be where we are without them.
And what did you make of Paris as a city as a whole? Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson was on today yesterday saying that the city still has some work to do in terms of accessibility.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't see a lot of Paris, but the one time I did go out, we did use the metro. And someone in a wheelchair definitely would not be able to get onto those trains. And, you know, I think it does take time for cities to kind of become more accessible and kind of catch up with the times. But hopefully the more we speak about it and the more awareness we make, you know, then hopefully change will happen.
the team, the swimming team in particular, was made up of experienced swimmers and newcomers. What can we expect going into Los Angeles in 4 years' time, Maisie?
Phenomenal things, I think. You know, this swimming meet for us as Paralympics GB, as the swimming team, was crazy. You know, there were just gold medals coming in every single day. So, yeah, the team were brilliant. And I think, you know, we got the likes of Poppy Maskell, who won five medals, Will Allard, are just amazing swimmers. And I think they're just going to get stronger and stronger. You know, they're only 18 to 19 years old. So I think the potential that they've all got is brilliant. And I can't wait to watch them all.
Is LA on your radar?
Hopefully, yeah. I think for me at the moment, it's just to take some time out the pool, rest, recover, kind of do things that a normal person would do as such, you know, spend time with my family, friends, go out, go on holiday. But yeah, I'll definitely try and come back when the time's right for me, and hopefully I'll get to LA.
Because you've retrained or trained as a teacher as well, haven't you?
Yeah,
so are you hoping to sort of delve into education? And
At some point, I finished my primary teaching degree this year. So it's been a whirlwind of a year, but it's been amazing to kind of inspire the next generation of children and hopefully get them on board with the Paralympics and disability awareness as well.
Absolutely. Well, of course, there was that open letter that the Paralympics team have sent to the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, about trying to make sure it's equal in schools for, you know, disabled children as well. And clearly that's an important impact that you guys can have.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, the more children see people like me or see other athletes, then the more they're more likely to get into sport and understand how amazing it is. And hopefully teachers and parents will see that as well. So, yeah, it should be, you know, so important to get children into sport.
Great to speak to you this morning, Maisie. Thanks for joining us. Double Paralympic champion Maisie Newton-Smith there. Enjoy your holiday.
Thank you.
Delith, thank you. In half an hour, it's the Life Scientific, and Jim Alkalili can tell us who we'll be in conversation with.
Good morning. Today I'm talking to a climate scientist who shaped our understanding of the warming world. Peter Stott is a science fellow in climate attribution at the Met Office Hadley Centre. Over a 30-year career modelling the causes and effects of climate change, he's taken on the sceptics and explained greenhouse gases to governments. But Peter admits he still flip-flops between positivity and pessimism when it comes to the future, questioning whether we can adapt quickly enough to deal with the effects of climate change. Hopefully by the end of today's programme, we'll have a positive answer to that. Join us for the Life Scientific after the news at 9 or on BBC Sounds.
To the weather, windy and cool.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson, and Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news at just coming up to 28 minutes to 9.
Around 1,700 offenders are being released early today as part of a government drive to free up as many as 5,500 prison places in England and Wales. The Chief Inspector of Prisons, Charlie Taylor, told this programme the government had no choice as jails were fast running out of space. Figures from the Office for National Statistics show average earnings for the last quarter were up 4% annually. This means the new full state pension is almost certain to rise by that amount, which equates to £460 a year. Under the triple lock system, pension increases are linked to whatever measure is highest, inflation, wage growth or 2.5%. MPs will vote today on the government's decision to limit winter fuel payments to all but the poorest pensioners. On this programme, the Business and Trade Secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, said the government didn't want to make this decision. He blamed what he called the black hole in finances left by the last government. James Earl Jones, the American film and theatre actor, best known as the voice of Darth Vader in Star Wars, has died. He was 93 years old.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It is now 27 minutes to 9. Central to the idea of European unity is open borders. Central to the image of modern Germany, has been its generosity to refugees, whether from Syria back in 2016 or Ukraine more recently. All the more striking, then, that the German government, a social democratic government, a government of the left, has announced new controls at Germany's border, starting next week and lasting for 6 months. It is said to be an attempt to tackle illegal immigration. Some think it's an attempt by the SPD of Chancellor Scholz to try to seize back the initiative following the success of the far right in recent regional elections. We're joined now by Jens Zimmermann, a member of the German Bundestag, a member of the Chancellor's SPD party. Good morning to you, Mr. Zimmermann.
Good morning.
Tell us, first of all, what these measures are and what they're not. It's not a blockade at the border, but what new checks, what new controls will there be?
Yeah, first of all, it is nothing really new. We had over this summer's two big sport events in continental Europe, the Olympics in Paris and the European Championships in Germany. And for an extended time, we already had these border controls simply as a measure against terrorism. So what's basically happening now is this will be extended for up to 6 months. And yeah, it's not a blockade. It will be smart measures. So the police, the border force will pick out especially cars, but it is nothing like having full border controls. This would simply be not possible because being in the heart of Europe, we have many, many commuters commuting over borders.
Mm. And yet, there is an idea, not just that you try to identify terrorists, criminals, but also illegal migrants crossing the border and to send them back, which has led the Austrian Interior Minister to say that he will not take them back. There is no room for manoeuvre, he told your Bild newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, this shows that this is not only a German debate, it is a debate within the European Union, within the Schengen area, because the problem is, and the Austrians are one of the countries who had a neat idea how to deal with refugees when they are coming from Italy, for example. They simply pointed 100 kilometer this direction, and then there will be Germany. And so I think it won't work like that in the future. And for the whole year in Brussels, there has been a debate, and there also has been agreed on more common measures to deal with migration.
Just to be clear, though, so if an asylum seeker arrives at the German border without the right documents or is already registered in another country, is your government, is the German government now saying we'll send them back?
We are saying this all already today, and it has been done because this is part of the Dublin Agreement. So if an asylum seeker enters the European Union and applies in a certain country for asylum, this country will be responsible to deal with the whole process. And
I understand you're playing this down, Mr. Zimmerman, as much of a change. There's no doubt tonally, if not in policy, this is quite a change from Chancellor Scholz's party, isn't it? Your party, in response to the rise of the right.
It isn't a change, but we definitely pointing much more out that if we want to give shelter to hundreds of thousands and millions of people, it is crucial that also rules are being followed, because we had dramatic stabbings in Solingen a couple of weeks ago, and also in Mannheim earlier this year. And you know also from the situation in the United Kingdom that people are afraid of attacks like that. So the government has to deal with it. But in addition to that, we know exactly from that terrorist who did that attack in Solingen that he was one of those cases. He should have been sent back to Bulgaria, because this is where he entered first the European Union. But our forces here in Germany, the authorities in North Rhine-Westphalia, they weren't simply able to find that person, send him back within the 6 months you have to send him back. And after 6 months, that terrorist reappeared, got social security benefits again. And people in Germany, they are asking, how can something like that happen? And the Chancellor and myself, we understand that people are asking these questions. So we are not implementing any new legislation on that. We are simply trying to enforce the existing.
That's very clear. Jens Zimmermann from the German Bundestag, representative of the SPD, the Chancellor's party. Thanks for talking to us about that important development.
22 minutes to 9 is the time. If America goes down a rabbit hole of balmy conspiracy theories, there is a significant risk that it drags the rest of us down with it, which is why season 2 of the award-winning podcast The Coming Storm is being awaited with such great interest by so many. It's on BBC Sounds from today. The first series looked at the madness that has gripped some Americans, but also at what the wellsprings are of the conspiracist mindset, and indeed the simple fact that some things that are labelled as misinformation or disinformation can turn out to be eventually true, and that this kind of thinking has a rich history in the USA. Gabriel Gatehouse, who is responsible for it all, is here in the studio. Former BBC journalist, of course, but now struck out on his own. Good morning to you, Gabriel.
Good morning. What a generous introduction. I should say I'm responsible along with a very good BBC producer called Lucy Proctor.
Okay, well, she will take that plaudit quite rightly as well. Give us a sense of what the second series builds on, I suppose, what we learn in the second series that we don't from the first.
So in the first series, we looked at this kind of crazy thing called QAnon, which was essentially that Hillary Clinton led a cabal of satanic paedophiles and was secretly trying to steal the election and rule America. It was niche, but it was powerful. It helped drive some people into the Capitol on January the 6th. But what's happened now is that this idea about child sex trafficking and elites has completely sort of seeped into the mainstream of American political culture. It's just there, and not just on the right, really. And January the 6th as an event is a kind of, it's kind of the ground zero of it, if you like. It's the gravitational force. So, you know, a lot of people, millions of Americans, saw that event as this assault on democracy, an insurrection. But there are millions of Americans who see it completely differently. So, for example, in the first episode, we speak to this guy, Derek Evans. He was a West Virginia state legislator. He went to the Capitol on January 6th. He got into the Capitol. He wasn't violent, but he was, you know, he was there. He was part of the riot. He was arrested in court. He sounded very contrite. He said he was very sorry. The judge gave him a relatively light sentence, 3 months. But when he came out, he was singing a very different tune. He said he was a hostage.
I was a hostage.
Really?
Yeah. You kidding me?
All these guys
in prison right now are hostages, 100%. What do you think these people in solitary confinement in the D.C. gulag are? We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
You can't be serious.
You can't be serious. Our founding fathers are rolling over in their graves right now. You should do some investigating into how the Federal Reserve came about. Go look at why we pay taxes. Go look at the interest that they're making on this. Go look at who gets to decide whether we print more money or not. It's all an illusion.
You can't be serious was quite an innocent phrase when John McEnroe used to use it. Not so much now. I mean, I suppose the challenge to that, as it was the first time round, is that, yes, a lot of Americans do believe in all this stuff, but actually the vast, vast majority, and it's a huge country, don't actually. And in a sense, it hasn't really infected the body politic, perhaps as much as we might suggest.
Well, I mean, you say that, and obviously these beliefs are on a spectrum, right? Some people believe that January the 6th was a fake, it was staged, and that's kind of at the extreme end of the spectrum. Other people at the less extreme end of the spectrum believe that these Jan 6 prosecutions are sort of political prosecutions and that they are being used to sort of tarnish Trump's support, which is sort of the lesser end of that spectrum. I do keep trotting out this stat, though, which is that when Americans were asked in a poll at the end of last year whether they thought that no matter who was in charge of the government or other organizations, a single group of people secretly decided events and ruled the world together. Guess how many people agreed with that?
Yeah, an oddly large
41%. So,
they're really saying that, aren't they? Because they want to feel a bit big when they're talking to
anyway, we go into the roots of all of this in the podcast and where it all comes from. And there's the John Birch Society.
Well, the roots, and yes, you mentioned the John Birch Society. So this cabal group back in the 50s, wasn't it, that had all sorts of weird theories about things that were happening. And in a sense, I suppose the fascinating thing, and you bring this out in series one as well, not much has changed in the sense that there's always been a strand of American thinking.
The paranoid style in American politics, yes, but it's very much back right now. So the paranoid style is back. The John Birchers, who saw everything through the prism of a diabolical communist conspiracy, Robert Welch, who was the founder of this group, thought that President Eisenhower was a secret communist agent. Right, these guys were seen as cranks even by arch conservatives in the 60s and 70s. Now the John Birch Society is back, and it's burrowing its way into Republican parties in states like Idaho. And so we look into these kinds of things. Mm.
You mentioned as well right at the beginning that it's not just on the right, that it's also on the left, that there is a kind of conspiracist mindset. How so? And what examples are there of that?
Well, so this kind of broad idea that the politicians you vote for are not really the people calling the shots, not really the people pulling the strings, right? I think this idea has become much more prevalent after the financial crisis of 2008, right? That there's this kind of cabal of bankers, financiers, elite who are really calling the shots, and whoever you vote for, it doesn't really matter. Now, that conspiracy theory, or maybe it's just the way the world works, right? Is that a conspiracy theory or not? That is prevalent on the left, and there's a sort of horseshoe effect going on here, which at its very extremes ends up looking like something that's quite similar to the kind of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories around the Rothschilds and blah 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 that we've seen for many, many decades. But that it spans left and right.
Gabriel Gatehouse, thank you very much. It is out today, isn't it?
It is. Seriously. Yes. You can listen to it on BBC Sounds. It'll be on Radio 4 tomorrow.
Right. Don't listen for another quarter of an hour, but it is already there.
Yes. Hold on. But it's well worth it when you get there. It is coming up to a quarter to nine.
This ain't Texas. Ooh. Ain't no hold 'em. Hey. So lay our cards down, 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 down. So park your Lexus.
That's Beyoncé's hit single, Texas Hold'em, from her album Cowboy Carter. Make her the first black woman in history to have a number one country song and a number one country album. And yet, she has not been nominated for a Country Music Award, which some believe is a snub to her as a black woman. Some, including Taylor Crumpton, a music, pop culture and politics writer from Dallas. When I spoke to her earlier, she told me why Beyoncé might really have expected to be on that list of nominees.
Cowboy Carter was a historical album. Not only did Beyoncé make history as the first black woman to top Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart, she's also the first black woman to have led Billboard's Top Country Albums chart. In addition to those two historical factors, four songs from the album, Levi Jeans, Jolene, Two Most Wanted, Texas Hold'em, were chart-topping songs from the album. So not only did she dominate music, but one has to understand the Beyoncé effect was prominent in fashion. Sales for Western wear went up. Searches for women's cowboy boots went up. And former First Lady Michelle Obama, as well as Vice President Kamala Harris, congratulated her on the album. It dominated the fields of music, fashion, and politics. So one would assume that the CMAs would have awarded her a nomination. But unfortunately, that reality did not happen.
And yet, yes, the Country Music Awards snubbed. Is that the right word? Snub Beyoncé?
Yes, the same Country Music Awards, if people remember in 2016 when she performed Daddy Lessons from Lemonade with the Chicks, she was subjected to an abundance of anti-black and anti-woman comments from attendees in the audience.
And is that what you think it is? You think it is race that she is trying to, muscle in on white country music?
It's not only race, but gender. Folks forget that country music is black, it's Mexican, it's indigenous. But however, the mainstream country music industry has tried to erase any type of contributions of black people, of Mexican people, of indigenous people. So for a black woman like Beyoncé, who's from Texas in the southern United States, and Texas has given so much to country music, what is country music without Willie Nelson? They have deemed her ineligible, illegitimate to participate in country music because of her race and gender.
You say gender, but there are huge country music stars who are women.
There are, but they too have experienced a glass ceiling moment where they can only achieve so much in the industry. You know, Maren Morris, Kacey Musgrave, they're two women who have spoken about the gender discrimination and mistreatment that they have experienced. I read a report earlier about how when Kacey Musgraves was coming up, a male country DJ objectified her, and she vocalized that, and then she was blacklisted from plays on the radio. There are still these archaic ways in which women cannot achieve full autonomy and agency in country music.
Given the fact that Beyoncé is one of the globe's biggest stars, will she care? Should she care?
That is a question for Beyoncé. But I think what so many black women in country music, and also people of color who are in country music, they vocalize concerns that, yes, Cowboy Carter was critically acclaimed and greatly received, but it would not be the catalyst to systemic change. And now, months later, after the album's release, we're seeing that their concerns are valid and true because only two black acts were nominated this year.
Taylor Crumpton from Dallas, thank you very much for joining us.
And that brings us to 12 minutes to nine. All primary school age children should be given free meals to help tackle the obesity crisis. That is according to a group of health experts, including the Royal College of Paediatricians and Child Health. And Professor Steve Taylor is on the line, who is the president of that college. Good morning to you.
Justin, good morning.
What would the impact be?
I think the impact would be on a number of different levels. For children themselves, who are obviously the most important in all this, it would mean that we'd be able to be sure that they'd be having at least one warm, nutritious meal every school day, which is a big thing. We know that if you feed children, and to be fair, adults as well, they generally work better, they think better, they behave better. And in the school environment, they learn better. You've previously mentioned that it will have an impact on obesity. It's not going to solve obesity overnight, but it will have an impact. It'll also probably have an impact on dental health. The biggest reason for children needing to come into hospital is to have the rotten teeth pulled out, and that's all related to diet. And finally, the bigger picture is that children are our foundation as a society, and I think that this would be a statement that we, as a society, value our children and want to do our best for children.
We kind of do it in parts of the UK, don't we? So in Wales, all primary school children, Scotland, all children until they're nine, and of course there's a scheme in London as well. We've regularly talked to Labour people about this in the past, including to Keir Starmer, actually, on this programme, who wouldn't commit to it. This is before the election. Do you get any, I mean, what do you say to the government? Because my goodness, well, we spent most of the last 3 hours talking about commitments they ought to be making according to various groups. What do you say to them about this one?
Well, I would obviously advocate it. I think it is the kind thing to do. I think it's the right thing to do. And I think it's the sensible thing to do.
Do you have a sense of what the cost would be?
Now, that I cannot answer. I suspect that depending on who you ask, you might get lots of different questions, answers. It depends on what the cost is. So there will be a numerical financial cost in the short term, but in the long term, there will be benefits to that. So it depends really over how long you're wanting to work out.
But that, I mean, that in itself is a fascinating answer, isn't it? Because we were hearing exactly the same about prison reform about, what, 50 minutes or so ago, that actually there is an immediate cost. Of course there is, but the long-term savings, but they might not be savings to the same budget, etc., etc. And that's where the difficulties for politicians, I suppose, come in.
You're not wrong. You're almost answering my question for me. But no, you're right. And you can link the two together. We know that a third of people who are in prison were children who were looked after by the state. So if you're wanting to relieve the burden on prisons, you know, you could look at early intervention and prevention in children. As I said before, children are our foundation. If we get it right in our children, things will get a lot better. But as you've pointed out, you need to have a long-term investment strategy as a government.
Professor Steve Turner, President of the Royal College of Paediatricians and Child Health. Thank you.
It is now 8 minutes to nine. Where is our bus? That's the question we had asked on the programme yesterday, on a day the government announced that in future, councils would be allowed to own and control bus services outside the big cities, that is. And we end today with a couple of stories of bus services not run for profit, serving a vital need. Sean Warren is operations manager for the Little White Bus in the Upper Yorkshire Dales. Jane Cole, managing director of Blackpool Transport. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Sean, first of all, the Little White Bus, that's operated in beautiful parts of the world. How does it work? Because you use volunteers, do you not?
Yes, we use a blend of volunteers and paid drivers. We're very lucky in the fact that we have a network of about 30 extremely dedicated and professional volunteers that help us deliver the service.
And have you found demand for it?
Oh, there's huge demand for it. I mean, we're extremely fortunate in the fact that, especially in the summer, we crisscross major walking routes, the coast to coast and the Pennine Way. So the number of passengers we carry throughout the year is about 40,000.
So lots of tourists, but also local people for whom it's a lifeline.
Absolutely. And it's all about allowing people to stay in the homes in which many of them actually were born and grew up, rather than leaving the small villages and hamlets that form the Upper Dales and perhaps moving away so that the whole community becomes a network of holiday homes.
When you say stay in the homes, you mean because they can get to healthcare, they can get to other services via your bus?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole concept created by North Yorkshire Council is access to essential services, which is, you know, can I go shopping? Can I go to the doctors? Can I go to the dentists? And we are there to provide that service either through the bus or through our hospital and medical transport to get people to be able to do that.
And Jane Cole in Blackpool, you also run transport system, bus system that is not profit driven.
Yes, we're owned by Blackpool Council. So we're what is called a municipal bus operator. So when the Transport Act in 1985 came into fruition, there were a number of councils that decided to keep their bus companies, and we're one of those. So any profits we make either goes back to the council and they reinvest that in the town, or the council reinvest any profits back into Blackpool Transport System.
You're still competing with other bus companies, though, aren't you, private ones, under the current rules?
Yes, we are. And every competition is healthy. I think what's really pleased me most about the government's recognition, really, about how vital bus services are in growing the economy and in reducing carbon emissions. So I think that, you know, working with other operators is a good thing, and it gives people choices.
Will yesterday's announcement make any difference, Jane?
It will make a huge difference to major cities and to local authorities that want to be able to specify what bus service they want to see within their regions. I think that's the important thing, that the local authority can have a hand in developing models with transport operators to better serve communities. I think it depends on individual situations. So, for example, Blackpool, we have our own bus company that is owned by the council. So we really have a mini franchising model in a way, but it's more of a quality partnership.
Yeah, so you're doing together a lot of what the government wants already, in a sense. Sean, what about you? Do you think it'll make much difference?
I agree with Jane. I think that, especially in the Upper Dales, North Yorkshire Council already support local bus services, you know, because, and there is competition, but there are not many people that can deliver that up here. And it's a very, very relatively low population in the Upper Dales. So I think that what North Yorkshire are doing, very similar to Blackpool, are that, you know, the routes go out for tender and we tender against everybody else. So they are already deeply involved. And I agree with Jane that I think I see this working for urban environments, and there are urban environments in North Yorkshire, but perhaps less so for those very remote rural areas.
Well, Sean Warren and Jane Cole, thank you not least for making me dream of walking the Yorkshire Dales or being on the beach in Blackpool, which is a nice way to slowly bring the programme to a close this morning.
Brings us to 3 minutes to nine. We've been marking the death of James Earl Jones this morning, best known, of course, as the voice of Darth Vader, but so many other credits as well for his recognisable face and even more for his recognisable voice. Adrian Lester starred with him in a production of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof in London and sent us this tribute this morning.
He was a giant in our profession. James was an amazing actor. I remember watching him play Troy Maxon in Fences. He was brilliant. Getting to work with him and be on stage with him, he was humble, he was kind, he was generous. He was always searching for ways to do our scene better. He would step on stage every night and I'd look at him and he'd look at me and I had no idea how the scene was going to go. He didn't improvise or you know, play to his whims, but he always deepened and surprised me every single show, every matinee. He never missed a beat. This is a man who's twice my age and I'm running to keep up with him. His talent was incredible and he was an example. His professionalism was an example to everybody who worked with him. He will be sorely, sorely missed. He was a great man.
That was Adrian Lester. And to end the programme, now a taste of James Earl Jones reading Edgar Allan Poe's poem, The Raven.
Once upon a midnight dreary,
while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore. While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door, "only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly had I sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now to still the beating of my heart I stood repeating, 'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. Some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more.'